720 WGN, high atop Chicago in the Allstate Skyline Studio. It is Dane here in for Nick DiGilio until 5 a.m. today, and I am not alone riding shotgun through the for the entirety of the program. We do have Dave Hammond is going to be here. He is the he is the dining and drinking editor for New City Magazine, and he has also contributed to our Tribune so many ways that
hey,
you
Dan.
See him. He is the I want to say the inimitable, the incomparable. The ubiquitous, right?
Undefinable.
The undefinable Renaissance man that is Dave Hammond. And so we're going to kind of tap into some of his adventures as we tap into yours as well. 312-981-7200. Is that time of year again where I think the world is coming to Chicago? We heard a lot from of great stuff from Jerry Nunn talking about Lollapalooza, where the world, not only some of the greatest musicians, or at least some of the more acclaimed or current or relevant or popular, however you want to categorize them, they have made their way to Chicago for the film, for this music festival, which is also a great food festival, too. Some of the best food on the event side. Lots of family fun happening at Lollapalooza. And then so many people coming to see all of that stuff. So, again, as it is in a bunch of different ways, Chicago is sort of the epicenter of something really cool that's happening. So we talk about that, people coming here. And then we talk about a lot of the things that we do on our show as far as transformative travel, getting out there, family road trips, experiencing the world. And so we have done a bit of that, and Dave Hammond has done a heap in helping of that, and he's going to share some of his experiences, some of the places that we are going to transport you, whether it's through our conversations or even some calls from faraway places where probably the majority of the population is awake. Is we're going to Ireland, right, Dave? We're going
to
talk.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, love to.
So we're going to talk some Ireland, some Mexico City, where you've been there, of course. This is a place within striking distance, is Door County. I have been there before, and it is kind of, it's like a world away, right? I mean, you get up there, but it's sort of that got that whole quaint thing, and you've got all the cherries. And
fun fact, Washington Island, right on the tip of Door County, huge Icelandic population. Icelanders just move there. You know, one guy comes, he brings his brother, he brings his cousin, and finally there's like a huge, probably the largest concentration of Icelanders in the United States on Washington Island.
So pushing 60, 70 people.
There are a lot. I actually went across there on an icebreaker from the tip of Door County in the winter, and we went to this place that serves Angostura bitters as shots.
Oh, no.
I can tell you more about that.
Well, we'll definitely hear about Door County there. Hey, it goes both ways. You remember a couple of years ago, maybe a handful of years, maybe five, the most where Iceland was thought of as a mysterious, far-off place that nobody knew about, and then now it's like the latest craze. Everybody's got postcards of themselves, like, sitting in hot springs and geysers and looking for icebergs.
It's like 4 hours from New York or something like that. It's a short ride.
So a handful, maybe decades ago, the same thing happened, but in reverse, people were talking about Door County in Iceland and how they get to get out there, get some pictures taken and do that. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Also, we've got some great topics, too. This is the kind of time when I think people are a little adventurous on the food side. And I don't mean necessarily exotic foods, but maybe odd combinations. Tom Hush, is our esteemed producer for the Nick DiGilio Show, is with us. And one of the things that he had is Oscar Mayer hot dog ice cream sandwich is both real and terrifying. It's the time of year where you hear about crazy foods and food combinations because it's like festival time, right, where anything can be deep fried.
Oh, man. I'll eat a lot of things, but the hot dog and the ice cream sandwich, that's really pushed it.
In deference to the possibles, is there's a few things out there. I'll try to think of some of them where, on paper, like if you described it, even with charts and graphs and maybe even some pictures and a PowerPoint, you're like, ugh. But we know it to be good. I can't think of anything offhand, but I know I thought of something not too long ago that was like, hey, that sounds terrible, but actually it's really good. I don't know where I go with this.
Well, you know, on the South Side, very popular, Nick Kindlesberger at the Tribune wrote about this. It's a school snack. You buy one of those pickles in the plastic bag.
Yes.
You know how they have, like, at convenience stores, gas stations.
Sure.
And you buy yourself a peppermint stick, and you stick the peppermint stick in the pickle, and then you eat them at the same time. I have not had this yet, but there are YouTube videos of kids enjoying that very snack. It's kind of unbelievable. I'd eat that before I ate the hot dog and the ice cream sandwich.
You used a key word, enjoying, right? So it was one of those YouTube torture things like that peppermint challenge.
No.
Or what is it?
Drink a gallon of milk or
drink
something.
Drink a gallon of milk or a cinnamon challenge, right, where you like try to survive a spoonful of cinnamon.
Or eat a Carolina Reaper pepper or something. Yeah. That's crazy. You can really hurt yourself.
Just made me think of some of our mutual enjoyment. adventures. And so, because Dave, you remember we both were in the super hot challenge with the triple X Scorpion Hot Carolina Death Pepper challenge. I don't know why we do it.
It sounds good, but yeah.
Actually, it sounds terrifying, and it really was too. So we're going to talk a little travel. We're going to talk a little bit of adventures. We're going to talk some of the stuff that that David has found. We're going to have some great guests on from around the world. So keep it here and stay tuned. We'll be back with more. It's Dane here in for Nick on 720 WGN. Sweet 720 WGN, high atop Chicago. It is the Allstate Skyline Studio. Dane is here with you until 5 a.m. in for Nick D. And 312-981-7200 is the number where you can add in your thoughts. Some of the things that we're talking about is suggestions, whether it's your suggestions, places you've gone or places to stay away from on the family road trip or the summertime adventure side. I think we've all, maybe we all have it. I don't know if this may be a phenomenon for maybe different generations or whatever, that whole kind of family truckster, get in the car kind of thing, get out there, see the world, be car sick, could be completely bored, have to go to the bathroom, pull over, world's largest ball of twine. Any of those that you've got throughout the course of the program, 312-981-7200, you can add. We'll add you to the program and give you a shout out. Before we went to the break, we were talking about foods. And this is the time of year where, you know, I think there's different times on the calendar. And Dave, of course, Dave Hammond is with us, dining and drinking editor for New City, contributor to Tribune and so many other publications, and I think worldwide adventurer. And this is a time on the food side where I think we do have a little bit of latitude, right? We're at festivals, we're out and about, we're doing things. We see it, you know, a giant sign printed on a banner that says Gator on a stick. And then you think, you know, why not?
Or Beef Sunday, which I've seen at, it was the Iowa State Fair, one of the biggest state fairs, I think, in the country. It might be the biggest. They actually have brick buildings built for the vendors to, I mean, it's like very official.
Well, I'm sure that is, and nothing against our, and of course, we reach 38 states in Canada, but for the people in Iowa, it's probably a very big deal.
Oh, it is. And actually, my daughter went to school in Des Moines, so we went out there to see her, went to the Iowa State Fair there, and so a beef sundae, in case you're wondering, is not quite as gross as it sounds. It's like big chunks of beef. It's like good so far. Well, whipped potatoes. So that looks kind of like the ice cream. And then there's tomato sauce on top. So that's all like savory stuff. It's not like you're mixing
kind of like really
ice cream and a hot dog, which I'm going to come back to as one of the worst things I've heard in a while.
So is the theory that if it's, and I think from those great scientists over in the world of Reese's, is the is two great tastes that go great together. So they could be great tastes that may not naturally come together, but if they're both great, like let's say applesauce and let's say apple pie and barbecue sauce, right? Both great, maybe not so great together.
I don't know.
I don't know. Terrible. I mean, like, have you ever had Oscar sauce on a steak? This is very popular. I find that an abhorrent combination. I get it every now and again, but it's like, who thought that like crab and cream would go good on a beefsteak? I can't see it. Now, crab and beef, yes, but it's that creamy sauce. It just is just weird to me. Now, I eat a lot of stuff. I eat stuff that normal people would be revolted by, but there's some flavors that, I mean, I love crab, I love beef, put them together with the sauce. I not my thing.
There's sometimes, too, things where people come down on, and some of these are normal, popular things that you see on menus, but there's groups of people in pretty significant numbers that have an aversion towards them, maybe based on, and maybe they can't necessarily put their finger on it, but maybe it's the texture, right? Whether it's mushrooms.
Oysters.
Oysters, for sure, people have issues with. I mean, because some can, because, hey, they're raw, they're kind of slimy and weird and unappealing. I personally like them.
Right? I do, too.
I like them a lot.
Too.
But you'll have people that don't like them, and it isn't necessarily about the taste. If you coat them in, cheese and, bread them or whatever, maybe they're okay. It's more about the texture, right?
I think so. Yeah, and they can look kind of uninviting, I would say. As you say, kind of slimy. A buddy of mine calls them sea snot. I mean, it's just kind of, green and yucky.
Well, and you have
people, but delicious
people too, as far as the the Tabasco sauce that you may put on it. But your purists, who understand and really appreciate the oyster, and from the different areas of the country where they get them, and they really they want to taste all of that. You know, they want the brine, they want the flavor. They don't want the, you know, the, too much lemon or too much, you know, or Tabasco sauce kind of masking the flavor. And I kind of agree.
I do
in
I
some
do,
ways yeah. too. Is that even on the barbecue side, and you know, where like barbecue sauces are great, and there's nothing wrong with it, and you know, fortunes have been made in that, and there's certainly something to be said. But just like, you know, A1 steak sauce on it, if you need it, that means that maybe the item itself isn't up to where it could be.
Well, I'm going to Virginia in a couple of weeks, and they have like 7 different oyster regions in Virginia. They do a huge business in oysters. And there, I will eat them all raw. But I find that in Chicago, when I order oysters, more often than not, they're going to dress it up with little microgreens or a little shaved ginger or something like that. And at first, that kind of turned me off. Just like you said, if you have a good product, do you really want to dress it up with a bunch of other stuff? And I can see why chefs feel the need to dress them up, because otherwise they're just shucking the oyster and putting it in front of a customer. They have to intervene somehow and mediate between you and the oyster. And now I find it kind of interesting the things chefs are adding to oysters. I mean, it goes way beyond Tabasco sauce or cocktail sauce, both of which I like, but both of which really cover up the flavor of an oyster. And if it's a good oyster,
yeah,
you don't want to cover it up. And if it's a bad oyster, you don't want to eat it.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I think simplicity, kind of the less is more in a lot of different ways is where it's at. I think it was, it seems like a million years ago, but I think it was yesterday. We had Jeff Morrow in studio, Sandwich King, and he had won, talking a little bit about burgers, some of the best burgers. I think Wendy had asked him about that, and he had won Burger Bash, the People's Choice Award. And so he knows a little bit about sandwiches in general and has some accolades on the burger side and the trophy case. And he was like, just less is more, you know, just the patty itself. You just make sure that you cook it right, you know, like on a griddle or something like that. Make sure the bread is good and it's toasted and buttery and all those kind of things. And I've been at those events and I've judged different events. And you'd be surprised. You can have, you know, Iron Chef Morimoto there doing all sorts of crazy things. And you can have lobster caked on top of it and truffles, all sorts of secret bacon, secret kind of irresistible ingredients. And then sometimes a simple kind of diner cafe kind of burger ends up winning the whole thing.
I was talking to Michael Muser yesterday. He's the guy. He's the co-owner of Grace Restaurant with Curtis Duffy.
Yeah.
They walked out of Grace in 2017. They're starting their own place early next year called Ever. And he was talking about Duffy's technique. Now, Duffy is one of two, or was one of two, 3-star Michelin chefs in Chicago, the other being Grant Achatz at Alinea. And Duffy's approach, according to Muser, is to go more simple now, which I think is interesting. He said, you know, if we go to the trouble of sourcing this great beet, for instance, or this magnificent carrot, why do I want to turn it into a gas? Or, you know, shred it and so you don't know what the hell you're eating. He wants the beauty of these natural ingredients to shine through. That's the story.
So the chef element in there, his interaction with the process is in the sourcing, is in the identification of what is great, and then the presentation of it in its purest form. Because you'd mentioned a little bit earlier, and I totally agree, right? If you're a chef and you've got all these things, you've got these oysters, you've got whatever it is, if you don't intervene and inject your either personality, talent, or technique,
people are going to wonder what you're doing.
Yeah,
it's what's like, your job again?
But if you can remind people that only I can seek the world over and find this magnificent carrot, right?
And this is all goes back to Chez Panisse, you know, where Alice Waters would serve for dessert a single peach. You know, it was just a perfectly sourced peach. I don't even know if she cut it for people. You know, it was just like, right. Here it is. I found it. It's great. I can't improve on that. And I think there's something to that.
312-981-7200. You know, you've got the kind of pristine versions of things that you can enjoy, whether it's the perfect peach or Dave's magnificent carrot, you know, and you can kind of tell the backstory, have like the genealogy, the 23andMe, if you will, of the carrots. You can see exactly what parts of the world all of the little atoms included in it.
Can I see the DNA screen on this carrot, please?
That's right. I'm sure you get it. It comes right through it. It's next to it. And you can read, oh, wow, okay, this carrot's part Idaho. I don't know. But other than that, there's great ways to combine things. And so we did have a caller from the 815 and 312-981-7200. You can add your thoughts into some of the crazy food combinations either you've seen, some foods at festivals, or even things that you've tried, that or maybe some family kind of things that people have, like traditions that may be odd to the outside world or the uninitiated, that maybe you've tried. From the 815, we got a texter, and it was reported on WGN, they're coming out with mustard ice cream. Now, the ice cream world, had, you know, over the last X amount of years has changed. You know, you used to have, I remember growing up, like you knew
31 flavors.
Well,
that was it.
Well, that was like space age to do that. The stuff that I remember really having access to, David, was I knew I was really living when there was three different colors in the Neapolitan tub of ice cream, you know. And if it was really a great day, it was the mint chocolate chip. I think that was when we were pushing the envelope on Nirvana. But now you have chefs or people with maybe added culinary sensibilities and then a taste for the ice cream world, adding all sorts of different like spices, herbs, and things into ice cream.
You know, a really fun place to find unusual flavors in ice cream is at the Mexican ice cream parlors, Neverias, I think they're called. All kinds of like papaya, mango, different types of pepper, celery, worked into like an ice cream type or a sorbet type confection. Really, they're good.
I could see that. I could see like a celery kind of sorbet.
Refreshing?
I could see that being kind of good.
Green, but refreshing. Yeah.
Less refreshing might be the bananas and mayo. And so there's a little bit of advice on the recipe side, too.
I'd like to talk to a person who likes that. If anybody's out there who actually likes bananas and mayo.
And you can go ahead and try it right now if you want, and then give us a call. Spread mayo on some bread and slice the banana up to make a delicious sandwich. Elvis, of course, the peanut butter and banana sandwich, which I think was, I don't know, I know that you mentioned when, and for the listeners that may not remember, David was, he covered the Tupelo Elvis Fest, right?
Yes.
Where Elvises were on display in quantity.
18 Elvi.
And they celebrated the life and the loves, including maybe the peanut butter banana sandwich of an Elvis Presley.
Yeah, I couldn't find any of those Elvis specialties in Tupelo, Mississippi. I think it's because they're novelties, and they
was
just
that really true? Or because did you find out? Are there any things about Elvis? We don't necessarily have to talk about it right now, but why not? We kind of are.
Yeah.
That are things that everybody thinks is, you know, are facts or history or true that really just got made up? Or
there are a lot of Elvis cookbooks out there alleging that these are, you know, Elvis's favorites, and you know, maybe they are or maybe they aren't. However, that banana and peanut butter sandwich is, and sometimes with bacon added in, is definitely an Elvis thing. I mean, that shows up in enough documented sources that I believe it. Or the fool's gold sandwich. You probably heard of that, right? It's like a French bread hollowed out with like a pound of peanut butter, a pound of jelly, a bunch of bacon. Well, you know, peanut butter and bacon, not a bad combo.
Oh, no, that sounds good.
And Elvis would knock back, you know, a few of those. There's a legend that he actually flew some of the boys, you know, Sonny and Red.
The Mafia, the Memphis Mafia.
Yeah, out to Denver, which is where these sandwiches originated, to pick up some and bring them back to Graceland.
Because you couldn't figure out the secret recipe for...
You need a professional chef to whip that together.
Well, it says here, man, that's
Sunny Red,
jelly and peanut butter. And, well, let's not chance it. Get on the Lisa Marie and let's head. So here's another one, and we'll do a couple of them before we go to break. Bananas and ketchup. This sounds especially horrible. It's a sweet and salty perfection. Maybe not. It's one of those weird food combinations. Seems pretty gross. Some people like it, though. Bananas and ketchup.
Now, I could actually see that. You know, there is a banana ketchup made in the Philippines. I forget the name of it, but it's actually a ketchup type. You can put it up, just like you would ketchup. It's made out of banana.
Ketchup is one of the things that there are some people that just swear by it, that it is, you know, it's their, I guess, salt and pepper or whatever kind of normal, the thing you put on everything, right? Where people put it on their eggs, they'll put it on, people put ketchup on a lot of things.
What don't they put it on in Chicago?
Oh, well, not without serious repercussions.
Putting it on a hot dog would be, and I think that's such a silly prejudice, you know? I mean, Chicagoans put all kinds of crazy stuff in their mouths, but the idea of ketchup on a hot dog, I'll kill you for. Don't eat that, man.
No,
don't make
people,
me hurt you.
They take it seriously.
Yeah,
I'll tell you a story. We come back from the break. Actually, when we come back from the news, you are working on a book that's got a little bit about some of the history of some of the Chicago food, some of the indigenous Chicago foods and delicacies, some that we may think are popular and why not everywhere, but really either just in Chicago or started in Chicago and are popular all over the place. We're going to take a quick break.
Talk about it.
We'll come back before we send it to news. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. Cool bumper music, Tom Hush, courtesy of The Quiet Storm. It is Dane here with you until 5 a.m. in for Nick DiGilio, Allstate Skyline Studio and Riding Shotgun with us is the one and only incomparable Dave Hammond. You know him as the dining and drinking editor for New City and so many other places where he contributes, including our very own Chicago Tribune. And so on the adventure side, and people know you from a lot of the travels that you do. You and I have traveled even at the same time and in the same places. But a lot of times, you know, oftentimes on the food side, too. And so to be able to be out there and experience some of the food side is great. To be able to create some of the documentation on, I think, the place and presence of some foods that we know and love here in Chicago is also great. So talk a little bit about the book that you're working on.
So Monica Eng, Chicago journalist, and I are working on a book. It'll come out probably in about a year and a half. We just started writing it. We're looking at foods in Chicago that are unique to the city. They may have spread out in a few cases to other parts of the country or even the world, I suppose. But they are unique to Chicago. Everybody knows about the Chicago hot dog, the deep dish pizza, the Italian beef sandwich. Italian beef sandwich in particular, Chicagoans sometimes seem to think that they can find that anywhere, right? Let's stop somewhere in Nevada and get it. No, you're not going to find it there. You may find some in Las Vegas at sometimes they open up, you know, a Chicago-only place. But there are dozens of other foods that are specific to Chicago and whose heritage, that is, you can pinpoint where they were invented, like the Jibarito, for instance. It's a Puerto Rican-American specialty. It was invented by a guy named Juan Figueroa at a place called El Borriquin. And what it is you take two slices of a plantain, which is a type of banana.
Right.
It's very starchy. It's not really sweet. And you smash them, fry them, they become planks. You put some beef on there, usually, although it can be pork, can be whatever. Mayo, of course.
Of course, the magical mayo.
Lettuce and tomatoes. And then you have a sandwich where in place of bread, you have these fried plantain planks. Very popular in, like, Division Street in Puerto Rican neighborhoods in Chicago. I've had them a few times. They're good. Problem is, though, when you bite into it, these planks don't have any give like a bun would. So they kind of, like, break and the stuff is squirting out. But if you get them fresh right off the griddle, right out of the fryer, going to be better. The gym shoe. You know that? Have you ever heard of that? This is weird as hell. It's a Southside creation. It's a submarine-type sandwich.
I've heard about, you know, sauces or maybe jardinera so good that you'd eat it if you smeared it on your shoe. Is that kind of where you go?
No one knows why they call it gym shoe, but you'll see it advertised like on even at some barbecue places in Chicago. Sometimes it's spelled G-Y-M. Sometimes it's spelled J-I-M, gym shoe.
Gotcha.
Nobody knows why it has that variation. So it's a sub sandwich. Got three types of meat, roast beef, corned beef, and gyros. Okay, and you got lettuce, tomato, Swiss cheese, onions, jardiniera, and here's the killer, tzatziki, which is like that, what you'd find on here.
Yeah,
it's kind of like a mayo. I think mayo may be the ingredient.
Kind of like a dill kind of aioli kind of thing.
Yeah, right. So it's and that's called a gym shoe, and you can usually get it for like under $5 with a can of pop. Soda, excuse me. although usually it says can pop on these menus.
Yeah.
It's a gym shoe, you know, $4.95 with can pop. A lot of people in Chicago probably have heard of the Rainbow Cone.
Sure, of course.
There's a place called Rainbow Cone, and we know the Rainbow Cone was, of course, invented at the store called Rainbow Cone. And it's...
Now, what's crazy, that's very brave of them, right, to name the store Rainbow Cone before they'd even invented the Rainbow Cone, which was...
They had a vision.
When you got
a
plan,
though. Dream.
Yeah, just make a plan and stick to it.
And it's pretty simple. You get chocolate, strawberry, vanilla, pistachio ice cream topped with orange sherbet in like a cake-type cone. Now, going back even further, the pork chop sandwich, invented on Maxwell Street... Where was it invented? Well, Jim's Original on Maxwell Street claims they're the ones who invented it. And a pork chop sandwich, and I got to say, the first time I heard about this, it sounded stupid, really.
What do you mean? It's like, it would be like a steak sandwich or anything.
It's
that's
a pork chop with a bone in it.
Oh.
On a bun.
That doesn't,
I know.
I think two words here, ill-advised. the restorative dental community is
the American Dental Association is wild about it. The thing is that there's a way to eat it.
Yeah.
You grab it by the bone, so you're holding on to the bone, and then you eat around the bone. Now, the question would be, why not just cut it off the bone?
Yeah, right.
But no, you go to Jim's Original or Maxwell Street Express, which is right next door, and you'll get a pork chop with a bone on a bun. Wow. Jim's Original is also where Chicago Polish came from. Maxwell Street Polish.
Yeah, yeah.
The Polish sausage. I think because of the stockyards. You know, we had these, used to have these Chicago stockyards here, closed like 1971 or something like that. All these meat scraps, a lot of sausage can be made out of that. They made it into these, add some garlic into it, grind it all up, put it on a bun with griddled onions, which you can still buy right now at this moment because it's open 24 hours a day. Jim's Original. There'll be guys standing outside after a hard night, you know, getting some belly ballast before they sail home. And I love, I actually, I mean, it's extremely greasy.
Yes.
But, so, you know, you one a year is probably about right.
So that's the recommendation. Everything in moderation. You've got the disclaimers, you know, the Surgeon General kind of label warning. One per year is what's recommended as a maximum. And then also, of course, with the sandwiches to, you know, make sure that your hand placement and your mouth placement is in the right place or else, you know, injury or potential death.
Right.
Could occur.
You got to know what you're doing. You can't just walk in blind to these Chicago creations. Let me tell you about just one more. It's called a mother-in-law. You ever heard of this?
I mean, I've heard of, yes, the...
He read the person who you're related to. No, not her. The mother-in-law is sold. It's sold at a couple of places on the south and southwest side. Fat Johnny's is one of those places. It's key. Anthony Bourdain visited there when he came to Chicago to have a mother-in-law, which is a hot dog bun with a Chicago corn roll tamale dropped into it. And a corn roll tamale, it's made by companies like Supreme and Tom Tom. It's like this extruded corn roll that has like a magenta core that looks kind of like meat, but it's probably just, I'm guessing it's there's a lot of fat in there just to give it flavor.
Yeah.
Pretty cheap. You can buy them at a lot of Italian beef stands.
Yeah. They're great.
Yeah. I mean, I like them. I like them in a mother-in-law even, which, as I was saying, is this corn roll tamale in a hot dog bun dressed just like a hot dog. So you get...
No ketchup.
You wouldn't have ketchup, no.
No, but does the ketchup rule, does it extend to the non-hot dog?
No. I actually think there may be... I'm not 100%
You need some extra special dispensation from the hot dog authority?
Call the Pope. Right. See if give you a pass on that one. So, yeah, Anthony Bourdain said it was so wrong in every way. But... They also make at Fat Johnny's a tamale boat, which I really like, which is one of these corn roll tamales dropped into a cup of chili, which is actually pretty good because you have like this soft tamale.
Yep.
And then usually I think it's a beanless chili, I'm pretty sure. And so you get like all the good chili flavors and kind of the carb from the tamale. And you put some hot peppers on there. It's nice.
That sounds really good.
It's nice, yeah. I'd eat that. I'd eat that right now.
So the thought process for the book was it to sort of identify some of these that may be favorites in and among in history for sure, but then also in kind of their neighborhoods where maybe they were created, but may not even be are accessible for people around Chicagoland, but may not be either household names or things everyone's kind of familiar with.
And we're going to dig for the history of these items, like where did these come from? Sometimes it's obvious, other times it isn't. The Big Baby is a Chicago burger. It's two patties with the condiments on the bottom rather than the top. You know, you go to McDonald's, you get like the ketchup, the mustard on top of the burger.
Yeah.
This is a small variation. The condiments are underneath the patty with two patties. In between the patties, cheese and onions on top. Now, Monica has actually tracked down the guy who seems to have invented this, but the problem is...
The intrepid reporter.
Yeah, she really dug for this. But, you know, it's hard to tell because there's a lot of place... It was invented at a place called Nicky's on the south side. But there's a number of places called Nicky's. They're not related to one another. And several of them claim to be the inventors of the Big Baby. So, you know, who knows? There is a way to go to dig back and find out who probably invented it, and that's what Monica and I are after, finding out who started these things. What's the story? What was the impulse behind it? For things like Polish sausage, it's fairly well documented how that came about. Pork chop sandwich, someone might have come up with that before, but it's so odd to have that bone in there, too, that maybe that's just some weird guy's idea of
and
novelty.
Some things, maybe just in general ease, right? Hey, I don't have to worry about the bone. That's an extra few minutes of my time. Why don't you worry about it, right? And then have your dentist worry about it. or, you know, or however it started, or maybe they felt like it rounded out the sandwich. Who knows, really, whether
it becomes
a tradition, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right, and becomes a conversation starter on some of these things. So some of the things that are popular here in Chicago or have created sort of like little mini legends here in the Chicago, and then some have traveled all over the place, and some are so popular here in Chicago that we assume that they exist everywhere. Like you mentioned, the Italian beef, which you could not imagine life without it. But I can't tell you, there's been quite a few people that are notables in the food world that have come to Chicago, had that, and had what they've described is almost a religious type experience, because it is, and I'll contend, it is almost one of the perfect food sandwiches in a bunch of different ways. And it's not like the Philly cheesesteak, you know, which is like a lot of these things, like greasy and super oniony and all that kind of stuff. Like the Italian beef is a thing of beauty.
There are some Italian beef places that do put cheese on it, though. I don't go that way. Yeah, why not?
You can put mozzarella on it. You can put the giardiniera. You can dip it.
Which is also a Chicago original, the giardiniera. You don't find that in other...
And that's the thing that we just think of, that even that word, you know, if I travel and talk with people, it's not a word that people are typically familiar with. Had, during the BBQ Smokedown, had some of the great barbecue people from around the country here. And Chris Lilly, 6-time world champion, you'll see him. Actually, he was on tonight on Food Network. They've got a Barbecue Brawl, a new show that's got 6 episodes. And so he's one of the biggest stars in the barbecue world. And Ray Lampe, Dr. Barbecue, I'm sure you know or at least familiar with, is a friend. And so he decided he was going to take him to Gene and Jude's and take him there. And so he was talking about all the things he likes on a hot dog, and he mentioned ketchup. And Ray had explained to Chris Lilly that would be ill-advised, and that you know, that someone would have a problem with that. And it would be like, not a problem like, hey, I would suggest. It would just be like, they won't do it. And they won't do it for you, and they'll you know, ridicule you in the process.
They don't even serve ketchup at Gene and Jude's. You have to go next door to McDonald's to get your ketchup. That's the deal.
Yeah. Yeah, so explain that. And then when he had gotten a chance to see in another condiment setting where there was hot dogs available, the bright green relish, right. He's like, what is this? Like,
right.
This is...
Right.
And this is something that we just see and have all the time. And it's the kind of thing that he wasn't necessarily aware of. And it's the kind of thing that isn't necessarily like sold or popular outside of Chicago. Mm-hmm. If it is sold out of Chicago, it's sold as Chicago relish.
It's almost radioactive looking. I mean, it's kind of a glow to it.
It's crazy. So we're going to talk about some of the other items that are in the book, some of the thought process of it, Dave's thoughts on food, and yours as well, 312-981-7200. Odd foods, too. You know, if there's things that you've encountered at a food festival or crazy, we've got some more texts coming in. We'll read them, 312-981-7200. Your kind of odd food combinations, things that you like that are a little bit different, send them here. Keep it here, too. We're going to take a quick break. It's staying here on 720 WGN. Smooth. 720 WGN here in the Allstate Skyline studio. It is Dane with you until 5 a.m. in for Nick DiGilio. When we're talking, we're going to be talking some travel. Stay tuned for that a little bit after 2 o'clock. We're going to have... calling all the way from Ireland. David is a guy that is, I guess, his hand on the pulse of most of, or at least the association of creators and distillers that make whiskey in Ireland.
Which is an ascendant dark spirit. In fact, since like 1990, Irish whiskey has been growing more quickly than any other dark spirit category, faster than bourbon, faster than scotch. Now, it started from a very low level, so, right. You know, there's a lot of room for growth there. But and distilleries, I mean, there's like, they've doubled the distilleries they had this year. I mean, it's incredible growth. And the question is, I have two questions for William when we get him on the phone. Why did scotch or Irish whiskey go from being one of the most popular whiskeys in the world to almost disappearing, and what accounts for its incredible growth right now? I mean, why are people drinking it now that weren't drinking it before? And what happened in the 20th century to make what used to be the world's most popular whiskey become almost non-existent by the end of the century?
Yeah, I'm sure it has to do with a little bit of a kind of either public relations or outreach or awareness, right? Or
Prohibition, I think, had a big
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that at least for here, you know, being able to. But then, now, I think just access. The world's become such a small place, and I think part of the reason why they've been able to kind of come back in such a robust way is I think that there's that pedigree, that history, that lineage. Is they have it all built into the DNA, and so they're able to kind of flip a switch and make a really high quality product too, right? And have all the elements I think you need for success.
And I think Americans are interested in trying new spirits like mezcal. I mean, like 5 years ago, no one knew what the hell mezcal was. And now you can get it in just about any bar in Chicago. Some bars are mezcalerias. Yep. That's what they sell.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of spirits and Chicago foods, we should probably address Malort.
Okay, go ahead.
It's been a spirit that's been around in Chicago. It's technically, I believe it would be called a bitter or an amaro. It's advertised itself for years as being despicable. I bought a bottle of Malort in, 2006.
And it's still halfway there?
There was a little like a neck, I don't know what they call them, but like a little card hanging around the neck of the bottle saying, 9 out of 10 men cannot withstand the taste of Malort. I mean, they're leveraging. This is, I think, unheard of in the annals of advertising. You're selling a product that's purportedly awful.
it's a challenge, though, it's a right?
Yeah, and it's like, be a man. And there's, if you Google Malort face, you'll see a number of photos of usually visitors to Chicago, out-of-towners, and some Chicagoan will go, hey, let me buy you a shot of Malort. It's a Chicago specialty. And they go, okay. And then when they swallow it, they take a picture of the guy screwing up his face in pain.
You know, I always wonder, David, how, when any of these products that come to some level of prominence, I imagine like a conference room, like a boardroom, where they're having that meeting deciding to go ahead and do this. And then they're like, this is horrible. This is terrible. And then the guy's like,
let's run with that.
Like, no, wait, hear me out. If it was just horrible, it's really horrible. It's famously horrible. And,
well, this guy was the guy who started it. The guy Jepsen, I think he was Swedish, started selling it as a medicinal thing, and then it kind of caught on in Chicago bars. And now, recently, the Malort name was purchased by Tremaine Atkinson at CH Distillery in Chicago, and he's making Malort, and he plans to ship it nationwide. It's a Chicago thing. So Chicagoans, you know, they're in Miami or L.A. or whatever, they see Malort on the back counter and they say, you want to taste real Chicago?
Well,
there's this terrible...
I'm sure, David, as you run into either colleagues that do similar things or people that travel or just friends that may find themselves in or coming to Chicago and they ask you those questions, they say, hey, so what about that Malort stuff? You know, they'll say that. Or, hey, it's all about, I've got to try the deep dish pizza, or I've got to have the hot dog. Obviously, there's, you know, so much more here than that. And so in the book, like, are there, like, what are the things that you guys, because you guys have done some deep dives on some of these neighborhood things, and I think having a unique perspective on some really untold stories, but then I'm sure there's some more kind of famous people, I mean, dishes or items in the team photo.
Like shrimp Dijon, which actually was invented in Chicago at Dijon's restaurant. I mean, it's very simple. I mean, if you've had it, it's basically like garlic and butter and breadcrumbs on shrimp. You know, they bake it, boom. Or chicken Vesuvio. Also a Chicago original.
Really?
You'd think it came from Italy. And I gotta believe, as an Italian, that maybe the idea of cooking a chicken with potatoes and peas might have occurred to an Italian over the last 2,000 or 3,000 years. But at Vesuvio, they started serving it. And people always think it's going to be hot, like Vesuvius, you know, the volcano.
Right.
But no, it isn't. It's, in fact, very mild, which is kind of the Italian way. I mean, if you go to Rome and you get, like, a spicy pizza, for a Chicagoan who's used to giardiniera and jalapenos and a lot of Mexican food, it's like...
Pepper flakes.
This is not, you know, my tongue is not burning from this. What's wrong?
So those are great stories. So were some of these things that you, through a little bit of research, that you were aware of? Or were some, are you kind of discovering as you're putting the book together for the people, are you finding some things that you weren't aware of? They're like, wow, I didn't know.
Oh, yeah,
that.
We're finding lots of stuff that we didn't know before. But like Monica and I had both worked on the Chicago Food Encyclopedia that came out like 3 years ago. And so we'd written some chapters for that. So we were kind of familiar with some of these stories. But we're hoping, in fact, we have like 30 different food types. types right now that we're going to write about, that we think we're going to write about. We may find more. And I'm kind of hoping if anybody's listening now and has a favorite Chicago original food that folks outside the city have never heard of before, that they give us a call. Because I'm always doing research, trying to find new foods from the city.
Now, is it just from Chicago, or are you branching out to Illinois at all? You know, because like you've got your horseshoe down in Springfield.
Yeah, right.
That kind of thing.
I mean, it's going to be basically Chicago because you know, at what point do we got to stop it somewhere? What's that?
Oh no, just continue. I'm just reading some of the text. 312-981-7200. If you've got, as David mentioned, if you've got your own kind of food items, kind of Chicago food item you'd like to suggest or share with the listeners, that's one thing. And then, of course, your crazy food combinations, you know, things that you've either seen at a festival or maybe something like family wise that you had. We have a couple here. I want to mention them too. And of course, you can add yours. 312-981-7200. From the 804, Fat Johnny's was my all time favorite hot dog stand with an exclamation point. So excited! Does the Rainbow Cone still have a layer of Palmer House ice cream? And I'm not sure maybe if that's ice cream.
Palmer House, no.
Maybe the Palmer House made their own ice cream?
The brownie was invented at the Palmer House. Bertha Palmer wanted to make something kind of special, so she had her chef whip
up. Was it like a cake that didn't work out? It's like, hey,
it didn't rise. Oops. It's a brownie. I think she probably directed him to make it that way or gave him the charge to come up with some original dessert, which he did.
Right.
So maybe it's that chocolate flavor, kind of like the brownie in ice cream. I don't know that they call it Palmer chocolate at Rainbow Cone. Maybe the caller does.
Yeah, 312-981-7200. And before we go to a break and then come back and send it to news, you'll appreciate this one, Dave, from the 847. My favorite Malort slogan, Malort. And we'll send it to news. Stay tuned. We are going to have a call straight from Ireland with that. Quick break, 720 WGN. Thank you, Tom Hush. 720 WGN. Again, high atop Chicago Allstate Skyline Studio. It is Dane here with you until 5 a.m. with David Hammond.
Hey.
Riding shotgun today. And as mentioned and kind of teased and promoted, excited and honored, actually, to have on with us. He is the head of the Irish Whiskey Association, helping to shape and share the message of Irish whiskey, is the one and only William Lavelle. William, welcome to WGN. Welcome to Chicago.
Very nice to speak with you.
So let's talk a little bit about it. I know that David was just there and an enthusiast of all things that were going on there. And one of the things that he was kind of featuring and focusing on was the Irish whiskey. And I know, David, you had thought one of the, I think, the most intriguing storylines is that in, I think, 1980, there was only two distilleries that were open at all, and now it's the fastest growing category.
Or even later. And hi, William. I would like to...
Hi, David.
Hey. I thought it might be interesting to hear from you because it's a fascinating story to me that at one time Irish whiskey was pretty much the whiskey that is one of the most popular spirits in the world. Ireland had many distilleries, and then for some reason, and you and I think discussed this when I was in Ireland, but I'd like to hear you explain it to our listeners. Something happened. Irish whiskey fell from its pedestal for a number of reasons, but now it's coming back in a huge way. I mean, the great number of distilleries opening all the time. I think over 20 this year, even. So, if you would, could you tell us what happened to Irish whiskey from going from incredible popularity to almost no distilleries at all, and then why now is it making such a huge comeback?
Okay, well, first of all, I'm glad you got home safe from your trip to Ireland. Yeah. It was a very good trip, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you go back to the 1880s, Ireland was the world's centre for whiskey production. Dublin, the capital of Ireland, was the global powerhouse. You had three distilleries which together formed Golden Triangle in Dublin. Powers, Jemison, and Rose, and they were the biggest distilleries in the world, producing more whiskey than any other distillery in Scotland, the United States, or anywhere else. And you know, it was something Ireland could be very proud of. Irish whiskey was the whiskey of the world. And then, really, the 20th century turned out to be a disaster for Irish whiskey. The United States was our largest market, and when Prohibition came in, the Irish industry, just unlike the Scotch, just stopped selling to the United States. other industries decided we used Canada as a back door, but Ireland just stopped. Part of that was because we had gained independence from the United Kingdom, but Ireland at that time was a very much a conservative clerical state. The Catholic hierarchy had a lot of control, and just social conservatism really saw a massive cultural shift, which saw Irish whiskey lose its prominence within the economy and society. On top of that, the industry simply failed to innovate and keep pace with changes in technology. So the column still, which revolutionised mass whiskey production in Scotland and was ironically invented by an Irishman, that technology was shunned by the Irish distilleries, who preferred the conservative pot still model. And all of these various factors combined to see a very, very rapid collapse in the Irish whiskey industry. So we went from a situation in 1880 to having about 100 distilleries to 1980, when there was only two distilleries left on the island of Ireland, one in Bushmills at the very top of the island and one in Middleton and County Cork at the very bottom of the island. And right throughout Ireland, there was nothing else. And at that stage, I mean, in the early 1980s, there was a real discussion on whether or not Irish whiskey would see the end of the decade, whether it was simply, you know, it's finished, it's an artifact of the past, or is there a future? And really, it all began turning around in the 1980s. You began getting multinational investment. So Pernod Ricard, the large French spirits company, came in and bought Irish distillers. You had C&C buying the Tullamore Dew brand. And then you had John Teeling establishing an independent distillery in Cooley. And slowly, those votes of confidence from international business and entrepreneurs, you know, led to the category growing slowly. But it took 20 years, by the time or even 25 years, before we saw any real movement. And when you got to the start of this decade, in 2010, it was still a case that there was only four distilleries working on the island of Ireland. And now, as we approach the end of the decade, the figure as of today is 26. It'll probably be 30, 31 by the end of the year. And we're just seeing this amazing boom with distilleries being re-established in towns and communities right throughout Ireland. And this really has been the decade of the Irish whiskey renaissance.
You wonder, is it... because here's what you have. Even though there wasn't anything going on for a while there, you still had these iconic brands, these names, this legacy, this history. Do you think that's really attributed to kind of this renaissance for it, in the way that you, like, if it was there before and you've got all this history and all this appreciation and knowledge, that it was able to kind of flip a switch, right? And it could either come back very quickly, and I think not only come back really quickly, but have the world sort of have that awareness and appreciation for it and kind of seek it out.
I think the fact that we had these iconic brands, Jemison, Bushmills, Powers, Tullamore Dew, that lived on in folk memory, particularly, I think, among the Irish-American diaspora within the United States, those brands meant a lot. That kind of intangible assets that was there was really important. Those brands at no stage died away. And I think it was important, as investment came back into the industry, that those brands were there to build from. But, you know, you mentioned flicking a switch. I don't think it was that easy, because it really was 25, 30 years. So if you take Jemison in the mid-1980s, it would have been probably the number one brand in the world, but it was selling only 100,000 cases, even in the United States. It took a quarter of a century of hard work. And one of the most amazing stories, I think, of Irish whiskey has been the global network of young graduate brand ambassadors that the company dispatched from Ireland. So young, bright people coming out of college in Ireland were given the opportunity with Jemison, with Tullamore Dew, to go off to cities throughout the world. A lot of those would have been in North America, so going to New York or Toronto or Chicago, or else heading off to Berlin or, you know, other parts of Central and Eastern Europe. And what they did was they simply built the brand. These young people from Ireland, over a course of 25 years, just put in the shoe leather, visited visited the pubs and the restaurants, the hotels and the liquor stores, and really rebuilt that brand. And in one sense, they're the unsung heroes of what we've seen, the rebuilding of Irish whiskey. You can talk about the master distillers and the craftsmen. You can talk about the big businessmen who put in the money. But really, it has been a story of, you know, hard work on the ground, and primarily by this network of young people who over the last, you know, they may have done 18 months, 2 years with the company before moving on and being replaced with someone else. But it was that global network of brand ambassadors who were critical.
You know, William, I think there's, despite the growth in Irish whiskey, I think there's still a perception. I'm working on an article right now called Irish Whiskey, Show Some Respect. And I think that there's, I talked to a couple of Chicago bartenders. This beverage director at Shaw's in Chicago said that Irish whiskey has a connotation of being something you do shots of in college, which I think might be true. And I talked to this guy at Osteria Via Stato, Dan Kurtzman, and he said, shooting Jameson became a huge thing in the mid-2000s, and it spread from bartenders to mainstream drinkers. Other Irish whiskeys just followed suit. So that I think that still, there's a connotation of Irish whiskey being something that you do shots of rather than savoring. At least in Chicago, that seemed to be consensus among bartenders. Are you seeing a shift toward greater appreciation in the nuances of Irish whiskey and perhaps, you know, using it in cocktails, expanding the use beyond just a shot?
Yes, we are. And I think the companies and the brands themselves are very cognizant that that perception has developed, particularly in the United States. So you would have seen over the past number of years some very concerted efforts by the brand to position their product within a range of consumption styles. So you would see people talking about preferred mixers, be that, you know, ginger and lime, or a lot of companies now would be selling the suitability of Irish whiskey as a component in cocktails. And indeed it is. It does, because it wouldn't have the peatiness of scotch or maybe the sweetness of bourbon. A lot of mixologists will tell you Irish whiskey is ideal for cocktails. So the brands are investing much more in presenting Irish whiskey as, you know, as something more than just a shot. But it is important to say that Irish whiskey has a lot more going for it than what we might recognise as the entry brands. I mean, you would have learned on your trip in Ireland, we have some amazing premium Irish whiskies, very good age statement whiskies, you know, unique single pot still whiskey that's made nowhere else in the world, or really high quality Irish single malts. So beyond your standard entry Irish whiskey, there's a whole depth and diversity and richness of types of Irish whiskey out there. And I think what we're beginning to see globally is that people who, you know, maybe started off drinking Irish whiskey as a shot have begun moving on, and in some cases moving up the value chain, to understand what else is in the Irish whiskey stable. And in nearly all cases, they are impressed at what they're seeing. And I think, you know, as more people get to learn about that diversity of Irish whiskey, it's even better for the category. But I must say, I did like your heading there of giving Irish whiskey some respect. I think we've come a journey to, I suppose, you know, re-educate the world about Irish whiskey. And now we've got that stage where it's becoming, you know, it's gaining its own momentum. And consumers really want to know more. And it's great. It's a great time for Irish whiskey.
Well, we're educating people a little bit about that right now. So excited to have you on. Let the listeners know we're talking with William Lavelle. He's the head of the Irish Whiskey Association. And when we come back from the break, we're going to talk a little bit about Ireland and Irish whiskey and the spirits and the association specifically with Chicago. We, of course, have an affinity, I think a unique affinity with Ireland. And I've got to, you know, before we go to break, mention too, Gillian Murphy from Tullamore Dew is exactly one of those great brand ambassadors that I had in studio on St. Patrick's Day with the River Dyed Green. And we had a few different cocktails that you could enjoy, whether it was neat or in some interesting ways that weren't just a shot. So stay tuned for that. We're going to be back with William in just a minute. It's staying here on 720 WGN. Okay. 720 WGN. Live here in Chicago, Allstate Skyline Studio, high atop the city. David Hammond is riding shotgun with me. Dane here with you until 5 a.m. Continuing our conversation, and excited and honored to have William Lavelle on. He is the head of the Irish Whiskey Association. William, welcome back.
Hi.
So here's the thing, like in Chicago, and we have a great affinity with Ireland. We've got a great Irish population. We've got, you know, I think a longstanding. It's a great city.
Many Irish mayors too, right? The Dailies, Byrne.
There's a bunch of associations that we're very proud of and that we love. And one of our great holidays here is St. Patrick's Day, where we celebrated in a big way, not only with parades, dyeing the river, and all of that, and enjoying a lot of whether it's the sights, the sounds, the foods, the flavors, the spirits of Ireland. And I always wondered, and I wanted to check, you know, with you, is this something that you and the people of Ireland are familiar with? Does what we do here in Chicago reverberate over there, and what kind of impact, if any, does it have?
Well, we are very aware of what happens in Chicago and the United States. I mean, I think the fact that the Irish Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar, walked in this year's parade in Chicago, I think is a very fitting tribute to the importance of the Chicago St. Patrick's Day Parade. You know, Irish people have had a tough history. We have a diaspora scattered right throughout the world, and a very large amount of that diaspora settled in the United States. So Boston, New York, Chicago, Cleveland, Ohio, you know, there are cities in the United States which, you know, every Irish family knows. In most cases, Irish families have relatives, cousins, aunts and uncles, you know, in cities in the United States. So there is a major affinity. And that's something, you know, we're very proud of. And I think for us in the Irish whiskey industry, it's also something that offers major potential from an economic and commercial viewpoint. For other categories of food and drink, you know, people will say our busiest time is the lead up to Christmas. In the Irish whiskey industry, our busiest time is the lead up to St. Patrick's Day. That's when we sell more Irish whiskey than any other time of the year. So St. Patrick's Day, it's an important celebration of Irish. For us, it's a very important celebration of Irish whiskey. And indeed, within the United States and in places like Chicago, it's a really important time for us.
William, we're hoping to hear from Jack Teeling in just a little while, and he may speak to this too. But I'm wondering if you could, for our listeners, tell us how Irish whiskey is different than Scotch. I think a lot of our listeners probably know what Scotch is, and they probably associate it with kind of a smoky spirit, which indeed much Scotch whiskey is. How is Irish whiskey different? What makes it unique? What makes it special? What makes it different from Scotch?
Yeah, so Irish whiskey, triple distilled in the main, doesn't use peated malt. We have a very different climate on the Atlantic, a bit more southern than Scotland. All of that means you get a much more approachable, smoother liquid, which for an awful lot of consumers is a lot more, I suppose, easy on the palate. But that means that you can consume it in a whole variety of ways, as we discussed earlier, either as a shot, either as a long stick, on the rocks, with a mixer, or in cocktails. As I say, Scotch would have maybe a sharpness to it, a peatiness to it that Irish doesn't have. And I think a lot of consumers across all genders and age profiles, they can find an Irish whiskey that's right for them. So as I say, it's a very versatile category. And I suppose that's why it was so big back in the 19th century. It really was an approachable liquid. And I think as more consumers around the world are rediscovering Irish whiskey, they like what they're tasting. And that's the reason we're seeing such booming sales right across the world, particularly in the United States.
Let the listeners know we're talking with William Lavelle. He's the head of the Irish Whiskey Association. And before we let you go, we've mentioned some of those iconic brands that everyone is familiar with when it comes to Irish whiskey, but there has been such a boom, so many new distilleries, so many new brands. For people here who are hearing this and want to get some more information on some of those new brands or just Irish whiskey as a whole, is there a place or a website that you can recommend where they can get some information on some of the new things going on?
Well, we will be launching next month a whole new platform in relation to Irish whiskey. But in the meantime, if you'd like to find out about some of the distilleries in Ireland, and even if you're visiting Ireland and would like to plan a visit or a tour of some of the distilleries, I'd encourage you to go on to visit irishwhiskey.com. And, of course, that's whiskey with an E. Unlike Scotland, we include the E in the whiskey. So visit irishwhiskey.com. We'll give you a listing of some of our distilleries that you can visit if you're in Ireland and also learn about some of the brands. But it's a very exciting time for Irish whiskey, and I think between now and next year, St. Patrick's Day, we're going to be launching a whole new range and platform to promote Irish whiskey. Indeed, I'm sure ahead of next year, St. Patrick's Day in Chicago, you'll be hearing from us again. And
right.
As I say, we're very excited to see Irish whiskey doing so well in Chicago and right throughout the United States. And just a big thank you to all the Chicago listeners who enjoy Irish whiskey. We hope you continue to do so.
Well, and thank you to you, too. I think it's doing no small part, at least some of the success, to the efforts that you guys are doing on the ambassador side, making people aware of it. That's how people know that they can kind of find it and then access it and enjoy it. So thanks, William. We appreciate you jumping on the show today.
Good hearing from you again, William.
Very good.
All right.
And good to hear from you, David. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to send it to news. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. WGN. It is Dane here with you until 5 a.m. in for Nick DiGilio, 312-981-7200. People are adding in their thoughts on their favorite kind of foods that they've had, whether it's some of the festival foods that they've seen, like a Gator on a stick. Have you ever seen that? Have you ever tried Gator on a stick?
Have had Gator, never on a stick.
Never on a stick? They say,
but why not?
Everything's better on a stick. If you can make it mobile, you can make it better. And so here's one of the things. So we had asked a question about the Palmer House ice cream, and from the 804, Palmer House was an orange ice cream with maraschino cherries, if I remember correctly. Does that sound...
It doesn't sound familiar, but that doesn't mean it wasn't sold that way at one point.
It doesn't mean that... Okay, so coming up a little bit later on the program, we're looking to have... Jack from Waterford, right, Colin?
Oh, no, Jack Teeling from Teeling Distillery.
Oh, from the Teeling. And so Ned is from Waterford.
Right.
So we've got a couple different people, and they're going to share. Maybe I know one of them has sort of an interesting take on the Irish whiskey thing.
Right. Waterford Distillery is doing some very interesting things. They are tracking where the barley from individual fields, and they're keeping it in this huge warehouse they refer to as the Cathedral. And in the Cathedral, there are stalls designated for specific producers of barley. And the reason this makes a difference is that they're tracking where the barley comes from, the characteristics. They're putting it through, like, gas chromatography tests, and it's defining its unique characteristics. Why is this important? Because when it comes to blending the batches of Irish whiskey from different barley fields, these different barley fields have different characteristics. So you're going to blend these whiskeys together into the most pleasing combinations. Interestingly enough, the guy who started Waterford also started Brooklottie, which is a Scotch distillery. They're doing the same thing there, trying to create a Scotch that truly reflects the terroir, the taste of the place, which a lot of people think is maybe not even possible.
Yeah, I mean, so some of these, I love the story, I love the backstory, I love the science end of it. And you think about something that's on the spirit side is kind of primordial as you can get, and you look at some of those early stills, and you look at the history going back hundreds of years, and you think, oh, okay, it is as basic as it gets, and it's great. But then you kind of blast into the modern day and from the technology side, what we can do. And on the grape side, you get it, right? Because there's a total difference in kind of the flavor profiles and the terroir and all those kind of things. It's recognized and it's, I think, apparent and pretty easy for people to understand and experience. But I agree, maybe some of it's a little lost. Did they ever, because you wonder if they do all this research and all this and they're like, it tastes the same, you know, whatever, right?
Oh, but it does taste different. I mean, people say a spirit is going to taste the same, or it's not going to taste like much at all because it goes through a distillation. Another distillation in the case of Irish whiskey, a triple distillation. So how much flavor is actually going to be left? And I think the answer is there's going to be some left. I mean, if you have like a plum brandy as compared to a peach brandy, they're both distillates, they're going to taste different. They're not adding all those flavors in at the end. They're fermenting and distilling from a solute, you know, from a...
Well, I mean, I get it on the fruit side, but, you know, when it's just, you know, on the grain side, it just doesn't... I don't know that it... It just doesn't seem like there'd be that much of a variance, but...
There does seem again, to be. Yeah. And here's another... This guy, Mark Renier, who started Brooklady, who started Waterford, now is in Grenada doing rum. And he's doing the same thing that is... And Grenadians are really happy because this is bringing a lot of industry to their island. He's tracking the sugar cane in specific plots all over the island of Grenada, getting the physical characteristics.
So that's like his thing.
That's what he does.
He's like a special forces.
Very precise.
Gotcha.
Kind of like statistical process control. He's getting the exact chemical information about the sugar cane harvested in different parts of the island so that it can be blended together into the best possible combination and tracked.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing. And this has never been done before. I mean, this is like a new approach.
Right.
And that's why I'm hoping we can get Ned on here.
Yeah.
As he's the master distiller at Waterford, the Irish whiskey distiller that's tracking where the barley comes from all over the island.
We've got a little bit of time before, you know, we'll be out here at 5, and so hopefully we'll be able to connect with a couple of those guys and get a little more of a picture. Excited to hear. Of course, you were there first and foremost. You were there in person experiencing it all, and it isn't all just about you, as much as that is maybe a big topic area and certainly an area of interest, but you got to experience a lot of stuff. So here's the thing. Chicago is a great sports town, and the...
I know where you're going.
You had mentioned that you got the national sport of Ireland, and I think a lot of people would say, okay, soccer, football is popular everywhere, right? Maybe it's the most popular, but no, right? There's another thing.
I found out about this sport from Ned at Waterford Distillery, because he played hurling, and now one of his two sons does hurling, and I wasn't exactly sure what it was, but I'm not much of a sports guy at all, but my wife and I ended up going to a pub while we were in Ireland, specifically to watch a hurling match.
On television, or was it?
It was on TV.
Okay, because darts is popular in certain, and you can watch that in the pub, right?
Hurling's a lot more violent than darts. Someone described it as a combination of soccer, ballet, and murder. And the way it's a lot like soccer in that you score goals, but and there's a ball, but you don't kick the ball. You balance the ball on a stick, a kind of a paddle, and you can carry it down the field. You can pass it, but you can also whack guys with this stick. And I don't claim to be familiar with all the rules of this game, but I know that just a few years ago, they started wearing helmets, which was kind of a new thing. But there's too many head injuries, and also there still are many injuries to the larynx, because people get laryngeal injuries. People get whacked with a stick, and, you know, that can do some damage. So now, Dane, correct me if I'm wrong, but you played hurling at some point, didn't you?
When we were texting back and forth, and we were talking a little bit about Irish whiskey, and I said that maybe that's a sport that I played hurling after too much Irish whiskey. I was just joking, hangover
sense. Where would you play that? Yeah, I don't know that it's played very often in the United States.
I just meant I was getting sick, like in the hangover sense.
Oh, sorry, got it. Hurling of that. Well, we all been there. We've all played that game. The cool thing about hurling, the sport, in Ireland.
So you have this ball on a stick, and you can hit people with the stick. Is there some sort of a goal situation?
Yeah,
is it
right.
a basket?
Or oh, yeah.
It...
No, it's goals. Yeah, okay. you can throw it into the goal. You can deflect it into the goal. But it's all, I mean, the action takes place with the stick rather than the feet, as it would in soccer.
Gotcha.
Here's what really impressed me about hurling. It's all amateur. There aren't like professional hurling teams. These are guys who represent counties, Cork, Kilkenny, Wexford, and so on. And so you have to have been born in these counties to play for that county.
Really?
So you can't be transferred to like another county.
Can't get traded.
And these guys are playing for the love of the sport, to represent their county, which I think is so pure and wonderful. I'm not saying American sports are corrupt, wink, wink, but there is, you know, this is like just a pure expression.
Hitting
of
people in the neck with a stick sounds
right.
less than pure and wonderful.
Well, it gets rough, but they're defending the honor of their county. And They're totally into it, and they're not making millions of dollars. They're not making any dollars at it. They're playing it for the love of the sport.
Yet it's televised, so you can go into like a bar or whatever, and it's on television. It's one of those national sports.
It's the national sport.
And they haven't monetized it, because you think there'd be if there was some guy that happened to be really great at that, but maybe he was less interested in getting hit in the neck with a stick, and you say, like, well, here's some incentive, you know, Larry or whatever. Like, you seem like you'd be a great player. So there's nobody's getting paid or anything?
That's my understanding. We can confirm that with Ned if we're able to talk to him this morning. But it's the pub we were in, I mean, every time Cork scored a goal, I was like, rah! And you know, Kilkenny got a goal, and it's like, oh.
If I may chime in, my grandmother grew up in County Mayo, and she played a version of hurling for women. So there's men's hurling, and then women is called camogie. And she still has a trophy from when she used to play camogie back in Mayo.
Are you serious?
And these are Gaelic names, words that, in fact, whiskey itself comes from like whiskabaha, which is or something like that, an old Gaelic word that gives us our current word whiskey, which is an argument in favor of whiskey having been invented in Ireland. And there's no exact confirmation of that. But the idea is, what I've heard, the story I've heard, is that Irish monks brought the distilling equipment to Ireland from the Middle East, where it was used to make perfume. They didn't make distillates in the Middle East, Muslim country, of course.
Right, right.
At least after 550 AD or something like that. But they used this same equipment.
Were they attempting to make perfume? And then it was like,
look what we discovered. Well, the like, monks...
You drank all the perfume. And I feel great.
And I smell wonderful. Yeah, so these monks, the story goes, after St. Patrick Christianized Ireland, drove the snakes out, so the story goes, they brought in this distilling equipment and started making whiskey with it. And as you probably know, I mean, monasteries were incredible sources for alcoholic beverages, brandies, whiskeys, beers, and so on. Monks were...
For sure.
They harvested the barley, and they made stuff with it that you could drink, and they could sell that, too, for revenue for the monasteries.
Yeah, hopefully we'll be getting a chance to talk. We've got a couple other things on deck from Ireland. We're going to have Sheetra Stern on from Portugal as well. And I know people are thinking to themselves, geez, I don't want to go all the way to Ireland in order to be in a bar and maybe get hit with a stick or a paddle or see someone else hit with a stick or a paddle. I guess that can happen right here at Hofbräuhaus, right in the Rosemont area.
Good transition.
When we come back from the break, we're going to talk a little bit about that. Some fun and some imbibing happening close to home.
Oktoberfest with spanking.
It sounds like a recipe for, well, that sounds
trouble.
Like a pretty good time. Dave Hammond is with us and it's staying here with you, 720 WGN. Show 720 WGN here in the Allstate Skyline Studio in for Nick DiGilio until 5 a.m. It is Dane here with you. I've got Dave Hammond, dining and drinking editor for New City, and contributed to so many other things with us as well, riding shotgun and sharing tales of adventure and food and drink and a lot of excitement. And sometimes in order to go and have I think an interesting experience that can combine maybe a little pleasure and pain, right? You have to go no further than Rosemont, right? to their kind of entertainment oasis that they built.
It's an amazing little, it's like a little town within Rosemont, which as far as I know...
And Rosemont is a little town itself.
It doesn't really it never had like a center of town like Evanston did or Naperville does. It's developing. Now there's like this little town square that has a like a Mexican place and a King's sporting area and like an iFly place you can go and like float in the air.
Virtual skydiving.
It's actual. I mean, it's like, I don't know how they do it. I think there's air like rushing up and you wear a helmet and you just kind of float around in there. And in there is the Hofbräuhaus. Now, if you don't know, Hofbräuhaus is like a 400-year-old beer hall in Munich. Figures prominently in German history, specifically in the 20s. Adolf Hitler actually painted the Hofbräuhaus, did watercolors of it when he was a kid, because he used to be an artist, quote, quote. And
sometimes you need to break from some of your early spokespeople. Subway with Jared, you know, you just have to let them go.
Right.
So good to see Hofbräuhaus making new friends.
Right, let that go. But then he did give a presentation in like 1920 something. Hitler did, like, it was called "Why We Are Anti-Semites" or something like that at the Hofbrauhaus. So it has kind of a checkered history. But when we were there in 1971, I was there with a bunch of buddies. It was all kind of fun. You can go into more detail on that if you want to.
Sure.
Well, okay. The it really weird thing happened. So buddies and I are sitting at these long wooden tables.
And just to paint the picture for the listeners, you know, what I think of is I think of like a big open room with long kind of picnic table kind of thing situations, you know, where everyone's sitting there. Lots of beer steins, lots of the St. Pauli girl type dresses, you know.
Dirndls,
You know, where they've got the kind of the, you know, just the whole kind of.
And these women were carrying like a dozen mugs, these huge like ceramic Hofbrauhaus mugs, six in each hand. Big girls, right? Carrying these mugs. And so we're all drinking. We're having a good time. And these German guys come and sit down in front of us. And we're talking and we're toasting with our steins and having a good time. And after about the second or third beer, this German man in front of me looks me in the eye and says, "Are you a Jew?" Which is quite a thing for him to ask. And I should have said, "Go to hell." But instead I said, "No, why do you ask?" And he said, "Because I'm a Nazi, a new Nazi." Now that is an outrageous thing to say in any context, but in Germany, they're very, very sensitive about that. Now,
I could imagine.
You cannot display the swastika. I mean, that's actually, like, against the law. You can't even collect Nazi paraphernalia in Germany because it's such a painful part of their history, and they don't want to ever see it again. So they're really strict about it. So anyway, that was kind of an awful experience. My experience in Hofbrauhaus in Rosemont, quite a bit different.
Totally different.
And they actually added what turns out to be a twist on the Hofbrauhaus experience. So we were just there last night. God, it was last night. Yeah, and we had been there for Oktoberfest years ago. And they have a great German beer. They actually use hops and grains and yeasts from Munich, attempting to duplicate as closely as they can in Rosemont the actual lagers that you would enjoy in Munich.
If you drive by it, and for the listeners, it is, you pass kind of that Rosemont area where you would get to where you'd have to go west in order to, you were right around by the airport there, and you can see it, that entire, I'll call it an entertainment complex, and they've got, there's a minor league, you know, baseball stadium on one side of the road, and then you've got this whole area, including Hofbrauhaus, on the eastern side of 294, and it looks, it's big, right? So it's not just a,
it's like a town square.
A bar, it's, well, Hofbrauhaus itself is big.
Oh,
it's
yes.
like a restaurant and everything, so it seems like it's pretty significant. And
a brewery.
The name that they've got there, are there ties to the original location?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. It's under license from the original location.
Gotcha.
And there are a number of different franchise locations in the United States. They're called Hofbrauhaus, and my understanding is they have to send, I know the place in Rosemont does this, they have to send samples every month to Munich so that they can test the beer to make sure, again, you know, this very scientific approach, make sure that it matches up in its flavor profile and its chemistry to the same beer they've been serving at the Hofbrauhaus in Munich.
Well, that's what you
for
want
like
to see.
400 years.
Yeah. I mean, you would like to see that so that if you can feel, you know, like you are getting, at least on the flavor side, some of that same experience. And of course, they're building in the ambiance and maybe some traditions, maybe new ones, right?
That you maybe a new tradition. Well, I got one for you. So we're in the Hofbrauhaus. This is during Oktoberfest about 3 years ago. And my wife and I, and there were some other folks there, and we're eating this great sausage, stuff I really like, vice versa. And currywurst. I can tell you more about those if you're interested. The so after dinner, the gals who were serving us the beer come around and offer spankings to people, and they've got these,
it's an additional service, you know.
They've got these paddles like tucked into the back of their dirndls, and there's this German, I don't know if they were a German couple or not, they looked German. They looked almost stereotypically German.
That with is, the lederhosen and the...
They had lederhosen. They're blue-eyed blondes. They're sturdy as hell. You know, they look like they could have come off a poster for, you know...
Don't say it.
I'm not saying it, but you know what I'm talking about. They're good-looking people, okay?
Right.
And they're, you know, they're standing up, they bend over the table, and the servers are whacking them on the butt. It's part of the deal at the Hofbrauhaus in Rosemont. So I asked the general manager, like after dinner, I'm walking out, and I said, so this spanking, is that like a German thing? And he said, no. In fact, it started in Vegas, and now we do it in Rosemont. And those are the only two locations
where spankings are administered.
And you, right, gleefully. And you can buy T-shirts at the Rosemont location that say, you know, I got spanked at the Hofbrauhaus in Rosemont.
So strange.
It is such a thing. And there's all, you can get little like keychains and stuff with the spanking paddles on there. Have you ever, were you in a fraternity in college?
I was, yes.
I mean, some college fraternities used to have those paddles with like the Greek letters on them.
I had to explain to my kids what that was and like who my big brother was, you know, or whatever, and then and how that whole thing worked. But yeah, now I don't know what the, here's the connection, and here's an obvious connection, is there, we certainly, there was a lot of beer that was consumed in the fraternal situation.
Not can spanking be far behind?
So is it anytime you've got a lot of beer hanging around and a lot of people hanging around, someone's bound to get spanked, I guess. But so yes, but I don't know where the German connection is, right? And then were the ladies here that are serving, you mentioned that they're sturdy and you got to be, right? They would,
oh,
you
yeah.
see those pictures of them having just, those steins are huge. That, you know, if
and
you want,
heavy. Yeah, they're really heavy.
If you want to be able to dish out a lot of spankings, you're going to want to be physically ready for it. Maybe they would be that, but I don't necessarily see them as disciplinarians. Like,
it's all in fun. I mean, they're not really punishing you. Although on the topic of punishment, maybe we can flip back to Irish whiskey for a moment.
Oh, I guess
we can get back to the spanking of the Hofbrauhaus, but. An article of mine came out in Gastro Obscura today. It's a website. It means like dark world, or actually dark food. There's Atlas Obscura and there's Gastro Obscura. And they just, and like they like the writers to examine obscure themes. So Jameson Distillery in Middleton, Ireland, has a punishment book. The one we saw came from like the 1950s. And what it is this. It's like this lined notebook. It says punishment book on the cover. They list the infractions that employees have committed and the punishments they receive. The major infraction that employees might be guilty of is smoking at the distillery. A lot of people still smoke in Ireland. The problem is, you smoke around all that alcohol and all that barley dust and so on, that's a huge fire hazard.
You don't want to blow up.
That would be the risk. Or if people steal the whiskey and try to sell it off-site, which some people did, that's also a huge infraction, not only because it's stealing from the distillery, but because it's evading the revenue. I mean, the revenue guys want to, you know, tax every ounce of whiskey that goes out of there, and if it's going out surreptitiously and illegally, they can't tax it. Anyway, so there's this punishment book, and the punishment was, in almost all cases, withdrawal of the daily liquor allowance. So when these guys got to the Jameson Distillery in the morning, they get a shot of whiskey. When they're going home in the evening, they get a shot of whiskey. If they misbehave, like if they smoke on the premises or steal, which is, I would think, be even a, you know, well, they're both bad offenses, you get your liquor allowance withdrawn, oh. Which is better than cutting their pay or docking their pay, because these guys, you know, that hurts their family, too. However, losing their whiskey allowance every day also hurts.
Built into the 401k plan, the benefit program there is you get extra, instead of like weeks of vacation, you get how many shots of whiskey?
Two. You got two. You got one in the morning and one before you left for the evening. And I asked the woman at the Guinness Distillery and Guinness Brewery in Dublin whether they had anything like a punishment book or that, or a whiskey, or a drink allowance, a beer allowance, a Guinness stout allowance. And she said, yeah, what they do, they would have like a 10:30 in the morning or so, morning break, you get a stein of Guinness. In the afternoon, you know, 2:33, you get a stein of Guinness, which is good because you get to know the product, and it also probably...
yeah, but after hundreds of them, are you pretty familiar with
it? Well, you only get two, you know, and yeah. It's just beer. It's just beer. And it probably increases people's enthusiasm for their job to have a blast of Guinness. And that's something that can be, she didn't say they did this, but it was certainly always an option to withdraw that allowance if you misbehave. You know, you come late, sorry, you don't get your Guinness for the day.
Either way, the punishments, the transgressions are immortalized, whether it's in the punishment book or at the Hofbrau House, whether you're on put up on the wall of fame of you bent over the table getting spanked. Now, and we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to send it to news. But right before that, just really quick, so was the punishment, did you have to, could you just get it? Was it suggested? Did you have to earn it in some way? Or was it part of like a Ed DeBevics or Wiener Circle kind of, like, this is how we treat you?
All in good fun. I mean, it wasn't any, I mean, you didn't have to be naughty to get a spanking. I mean, people wanted it. I mean, it's kind of a, you know, guys are sitting at the table pushing each other up to get spanked. And it wasn't like they are beaten at all. You know, they get like a, it's scarier than it look than it is. You know, I mean, it looks, you know, she's.
Welcome to the Hofbrau House.
Yeah, whack.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and send it to news. It's Dane here along with Dave Hammond on 720 WGN.
Hi, I'm Trisha Stern from Martinhal Resort in Portugal, and I'm on the road with Dane on WGN.
Come fly with me, let's fly away.
720 WGN, on the road with Dane, live here in the Allstate Skyline Studio, high atop Chicago, and on the line with us, excited to have founder, CMO, and one of those kind of visionary and inspirational forces in the world of hospitality, award-winning member of everything that goes on in Portugal, especially with the Martinhal family resorts and properties, the one and only Chitra Stern. Chitra, welcome to WGN.
Thank you so much. It's great to be on your show, Dane. Thank you.
Well, we're excited to have you on. And when you think about people who can be great representatives, kind of carrying the torch for Portugal, letting the listeners know that not only have you, you know, built an amazing business there, raised a family in Portugal, and you can speak to all the kind of great reasons that people should get out to see it. This is the first kind of time period in history where we'd have direct flights from Chicago to Lisbon. And I know that a lot of people are excited to get out there and see your home country.
Well, I mean, absolutely right, Dane. I mean, you've got those direct flights from so many cities now in the U.S., even San Francisco now, direct to Lisbon, you know, Chicago, New York, New Jersey, you know, New York. So fantastic time for Portugal. We're so connected to the U.S. as well as Canada. And, you know, Portugal is a wonderful country. Yes, my husband and I have been living here now for more than 18 years now. Time flies. And, you know, we love this country. My husband is Swiss. I'm originally Singaporean. And, you know, we call Portugal home now. So we're honored to be living here and adding, you know, innovation to the hospitality industry. But I must say, Portugal has received us with open arms. And that's something to say about the tourism industry. You know, people, anyone who visits Portugal feels completely welcome and embraced by the people here. So, you know, great time. If you haven't done it, you got to get out here.
it's a unique time and period in history, and I can't think of a better ambassador for it than you and Martinhal in the ways, because, but think about this, and Chitra, for the listeners, and I know so many people, we've talked with a lot of them who agree with this. When they think about Portugal, we've all got a globe and we've seen it, and we know a little bit about the history, some of it ancient history, and on the food side, we do a lot, so we're familiar with the port wine, but it kind of begins and ends right there, not too much past as far as the things to see, a little bit about the culture and the people. It's a blank slate. So it's kind of a big responsibility for you to be able to kind of be that ambassador for it. But it is great. I got an opportunity to check out for that first flight and got to spend some time in Algrez, and specifically the property that you have in Sagres as well. And for Martinhal specifically, you mentioned it, you know, and we've talked about it. You've won so many awards on the innovation side and on the hospitality side, and the thought process. This is just, you know, not another property, right? And there are things out there that are family friendly. This is more than that. This is family first. And it's amazing. If you can describe a little bit about some of the amenities that you have at some of those four properties for Martinhal.
Sure. Thank you. You know, it's family first. And I know that there are many hotels and, you know, cruise ships that are family friendly. And, you know, they're great. They're great for family holidays. But what we do is, exactly as you said, it's family first, but we put every member of the family first. So we work day and night to deliver luxury and sophistication for parents, you know, high quality food and wine, as well as amazing fun times for the children. And actually, it's not just the parents, it's the grandparents too. So we work a lot on multi-generational families and keeping every member of the family happy. And just to give you some examples of the services and amenities. So first of all, we guarantee interconnecting rooms. that's the first step as far as our hotel rooms are concerned at the various properties. But we also take safety into account with baby gates and, you know, little steps for the children to, you know, brush their teeth. You know, we think about the babies in every sort of, you know, because we've got houses as well in some of our properties, houses and apartments. And every one of these sort of house or apartment has a baby chair, you know, already there. You're not having to pick up the phone and call reception, you know, to ask for these extra things. I mean, obviously, you know, there might be something special that you want to call us and you know, we're there in a jiffy to provide it. But we really think through the customer journey, you know, point of arrival. And we have a lot of stuff prepared. We also have something called a baby concierge, where we have stuff like bottle warmers and bottle sterilizers and cots, you know, so that you don't have to lug all that stuff over when you're flying. I know, you know, my husband and I, you know, we've had four kids and we've traveled with those four kids. And I can tell you, we've been through journeys where, you know, you're struggling to keep things together, right? And so we've thought through a lot of details of the journey, long distance as well, you know, long haul flight, you know, coming over from the States. And, you know, we really work hard to make it as smooth as possible and as wonderful as possible. And, you know, baby food as well. You know, our menu in our restaurants have freshly pureed baby food. So you don't have to carry these pots of, you know, baby food with you or buy them. And, you know, you have fresh food pureed, which is, you know, which is what families want. They want to feed their babies, you know, fresh food as much as possible, right? So that's, you know, these are just some of the details. We've got the corners, what we call the kids' corners in our restaurants. You know, you either have a playground in front of the restaurant or a kids' corner, and the kids' corners are staffed, you know?
Yes.
Because we know children take a couple of minutes to eat their food normally, okay? And so, you know, they then run off and they're well entertained by the staff there. Well, the parents can focus on their food and focus on each other, have an adult conversation and enjoy their glass of wine. And so, you know, we have all these different details throughout our hotels and resorts, giving parents enough time as a couple as well, and grandparents some adult time while we look after the kids, you know.
I can't reinforce that enough. And it is every single detail. I'm not sure. I mean, so much thought was put into this. And I think thoughtful is really the word that can be best used to describe the family first approach to it. And for the listeners, you've got to say it isn't just that these things are available, is that they're integrated seamlessly into the accommodations as well on the restaurant side. And we do a lot of the food here, and Chicago's a great food town. The food that you guys have is exceptional. Yeah. And we'll be highlighting that. We'll put some links up at WGNradio.com. But yes, there is a playroom, you know, just right off with glass walls, as you can still see and kind of make sure everything's kind of going. But I mean, how great would that be at a restaurant where you're enjoying it, where you can say, well, yeah, for sure, go, you know, go 20 feet away and you can play, and you've got it staffed, like you said, with toys and all of those things. And in the rooms, and you mentioned, you know, some of those details, I'm a parent of three kids and we've traveled, and not everything is the, you know, the commercial you see on television where the kids are, you know, 10 years old. You know, when you're traveling with little kids, it was tough to travel at all. And in the rooms, in the bathroom for the place that I had an opportunity to visit, there was not only the larger toilet, but there was also a smaller toilet. I think it had like a frog toilet seat. So it was a little bit fun. And there was even, and parents will know this, and I just mentioned it on the air on one of our other segments a little bit earlier, there was a diaper genie in the bathroom already ready to go. And that is out of this world.
Yeah, you know, it's important. I mean, you know, I must mention that having been a working mother myself, you know, I've struggled, you know, with work and having children. You know, we feel guilty all the time, right? We moms, whether we're working or not. And so, you know, I often say to our teams, you know, we're working to enable the mother to have a cappuccino with the foam still on it. Because actually, this is, you know, it's the small pleasures that we are yearning for, right? I mean, dads too. But dads seem to, you know, manage to, I always say, my husband at least, you know, he can be calmly reading the paper while the kids, you know, fight has broken out. And so, great. You know, he can get through the paper and then look up and say, "Your kid's okay," you know, whereas the mother is the one running around. You know, I don't know, maybe I'm stereotyping too much here, but
no.
So it's enabling the parents to have their cappuccino with the foam still on it, because very often we're having cold coffee. We're not able to enjoy the foam on the cappuccino, you know, when we're with our kids, because, you know, they're wonderful, but they need attention, especially the little ones. So, yeah, so including the details is one thing, the hardware is one thing, but I'd also like to add that, you know, through the years we've worked hard on recruiting great people, retaining talent, you know, training them and creating a Martineau family. And, you know, I'm very proud to see on all the reviews that our staff, you know, the best place at Martineau is the staff, you know, and, you know, how they look after our guests. And that's hard to achieve, I think, in an industry, in this industry as well, you know. So I'm really proud of that. You know, we've worked hard on that, and I'm proud of our teams throughout our four hotels, and, you know, how they look after families is just, you know, they give them time, they give their heart and soul to their jobs.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've created this culture in our organization, which I'm very proud of. Yeah.
We'll let the listeners know we're talking with Chitra Stern. She is the visionary founder and owner, CMO of Martineau Family Hotels and Resorts. And it isn't even just like kind of managing and accommodating the kids' situation from the fun and the amenity side of it. It's more than just, you know, a playground to park them. There's thoughtful again in every single way, and ways where the parents can kind of enjoy kind of their time while still, you know, maintaining that connection while the kids do this. But I was excited to see, you know, not only everything is built in, whether it's the individual pools and the instruction and the staff and the things that you mentioned, but there's also even like a bike riding academy. I mean, there's things you just don't see anyplace else.
So, you know, the interesting thing is many of us live in cities these days. You know, we have less contact with nature. Kids are not even learning how to ride a bike. It's not easy, or swim, you know. So we try to, especially in our resorts, wherever we have a pool, we, you know, have it heated, first of all, so that we can, you know, welcome families throughout the year, even the young ones. We have at least one heated pool at each of the resorts where there is a pool, where there are pools, okay? Some of them we have up to five large pool areas. But, you know, swimming is one of the things we have. Bike academies too, you know. So in two of the resorts where biking is easy to do, in Qashqai and in Sagres, Qashqai is in Greater Lisbon, for those who, you know, haven't been to Portugal yet. And in both these resorts, we have a bike academy on site with different kinds of bikes, you know, for that suit the family. So you can go on a 10K bike ride or a 5K bike ride or a 15K bike ride, depending on what your ability is. And, you know, you can actually practice, you know, for the little ones, there's spaces on site, on the resort, for them to, you know, take their first lessons with dads or moms. And, you know, so bike academy maybe is easy to put in place. But I think what's great about the people we work with, you know, at these academies, they completely understand the kids and they're engaged with them. And, you know, we're also very sensitive that, you know, mom and son or mom and daughter or dad and daughter, dad and son want to spend time together doing these amazing things. I mean, you know, I've had people come to me and say, "Oh, my daughter took her first steps at Martineau," or "My son learned to ride a bike at Martineau," or, you know, "My daughter learned how to swim at Martineau." I mean,
wow. This
is amazing. These are amazing life moments that we have enabled, you know, by putting in the right details. And I think that's what makes me happy. You know, this is happiness business. You know, it's wonderful to actually see the families spending time together, being happy together. You know, usually when people go on a holiday, and this is the norm, right? The first 3 days, you it takes you time to start relaxing, you know. So we really try to reduce that time that you need to wind down and relax by having great staff around and, you know, moments, you know, creating spaces. And then we have all these, you know, activities that you can pursue together, family football, you know, daily family football in Sagres. That's such a great thing. You know, people just arrive with their children and they get into teams and then they play against each other, you know, and it's really wonderful.
Yeah, it's a real community there, and there's absolutely nothing like it. And helping families not only to be able to make some memories, get together and enjoy each other, but making, like you said, some of those lasting memories as they tell sort of the stories of their lives, and having Martin Hall sort of built in to those, not only those journeys, but those stories as well for those formative moments, I think has got to be not only really, really cool for the people that are doing, but also very gratifying for you guys as well. And so as we let you go, and I got to tell the listeners, there's absolutely nothing like it. And if you make your way to Portugal, Martin Hall is definitely one of those places on the family side. You don't have to have a family, but if you do, that is your destination. So Chitra, if you can give, you know, the website for people to get up information on where to see the properties and kind of find out all the cool things going on.
So the website is www.martinhall, that's spelled martinhall.com. That's martinhall.com. You know, we've got all the information about our four different hotels, resorts on site. I mean, with the American guests so far, the city center one in Chiado. I mean, the Italians would pronounce it Chiado, I guess, C-H-I-A-D-O. You know, our first ever city center elegant family hotel. That's very popular with the American visitors because they find a safe haven in the middle of the city, in the trendiest part of the city, to explore the city but stay at the same time. And we've got a kids club to look after your kids while you go and, you know, dine or eat at a Michelin star restaurant, or, you know, go to the bars, the fun and trendy bars in town. And we're there. You know, we have kids clubs and different areas for different age kids. And we're looking after your kids while you enjoy the city as well. You know, you can enjoy the city during the day with them, and in the evening, have some couple times. So, and I encourage you to look at our website, you know, www.martinhall, and find a property that suits you, or try out all four.
Yes, try out all four. If you're lucky, got some time, you can experience so many parts of Portugal and kind of and get acclimated to one of the best and most exciting destinations that's out there right now. Chitra Stern, founder, owner, CMO, Martin Hall, thanks so much for what you're doing. Appreciate it. One of the absolute best in the business. Thanks for jumping on the show today.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dane. Appreciate it very much. And it's an honor to have been on your show. Thank you.
WGN on the road. We just heard about that, of course, here in the Allstate Skyline studio in for Nick until 5 a.m. and talking a little travel and a little of the places around the world. And, of course, some of those people are awake with us and being able to kind of tap into some of those coming up at 4:30. We're going to talk with Ned from Is Ned from Waterford?
Ned is from what? He's the master distiller at the Waterford Distillery.
Okay. So we'll talk with him about some of the things that he's got going on. In the meantime, you just heard from Chitra Stern from Portugal. And Portugal is one of those places, just like it was with Iceland a handful of years ago, that has now become way less mysterious as more people go there. And I got to tell people, it is affordable, and it is very, I think, open and receptive to Americans. They speak English for the most part. It's taught in the schools. The movies that they're, the first run movies that come out, they aren't dubbed in to Portuguese, or, you know, like Spain and in France, they'll actually dub in. So, you know, Jennifer Aniston will have a, "Hi, I'm Jennifer," you know, a different hello. In Portugal, it's just, you know, they have the regular first run stuff, so it's super accommodating. A lot of the television programs, the people are nice, the food is really great. I think it's going to be a big hit.
Now, I went to a part of Portugal that not many people visit, unless they're in the military, because there are still military bases there. I'm talking about the Azores, which are located about 900 miles west of Portugal in the Atlantic Ocean. They're kind of distant from everything, but now there are direct flights from Boston, and there actually are a lot of Azorians in the Boston area because after a volcano blew in like 1958 or something like that, a lot of Azorians needed to find a new place to live. And John F. Kennedy...
Of course, you think Boston, that's where you got to go.
Kennedy invited them. He said he wanted... And he was a senator from Massachusetts. Wow. He invited them to come to Massachusetts, and so they did. And so there are a lot of Azorian restaurants in Boston and in Massachusetts.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, what qualifies... I mean, obviously, the... you know, wherever the location is. But what kind of food is Ori? Is it just island, you know, whether it's like fish or fruit or things like that?
It's they do a meat stew. I'm forgetting the name of it. It's kind of typically Azorean. They have a lot of cows in the Azores. In fact, there's like, you know, the Beach Boys sang about two girls for every boy. There are two cows for every person in the Azorean population. That's no joke. I mean, they have a lot of cows and a lot of bulls, too. They do this really weird thing every summer. They do these, like, I guess you'd call them, like, bull runs. Different villages.
Pamplona style?
Kind of like that, but a little cruder in a way, if I can use that term. They let these bulls go in the streets of different towns, a different town every night for, like, 3 months in the summer. And so
who thinks this stuff up? It's like, I got an idea. Let's let the bulls out here.
Well, I think it was the bulls are honored in the Azores because the legend goes that the wicked Spanish were invading Portuguese Azores and the bulls were let loose. They put like fire, flaming corks or something on the bulls' horns, released them at the Spanish, and the Spanish freaked out and went home. This is the story. And so they're on the actually on the Azorean crest. There are like two bulls, what they call would call bulls rampant. They're kind of like running on the Azorean crest. So these bullfights are they a different town every night? Small towns in the Azores. They bring a bull in, and the townspeople taunt the bull with umbrellas. It's like poking the bull with sticks. The bull goes crazy.
It's got to be an umbrella. Can't just be.
They use umbrellas for some reason. I think they twirl it and that kind of. Gets the bull's eye, and you're like, rawr! So, and the bull is chasing these guys, mostly young men, who may have had a drink or two before right. They do this. And the bull basically chases them through the town. Now, the bulls are restrained. They're like five or six guys wearing white shirts and kind of toreador hats. They have a rope that they're all holding on to that's attached around the bull's neck. Otherwise, the bull would kill, you know, just kill people because he's furious as hell. They're really nice to the bull, though. The bull has to do, like, one of these fights every 2 to 3 weeks. And
so strange.
It is odd. And it's, yeah, mostly young guys poking the bull, you know, trying to get it angry. And then the bull chases them, and the guys with the rope kind of let it go a little bit to increase the excitement. And people are protected. We were watching it from a bar, like on a second story, and they had put up like plywood on the steps to the bar so the bull couldn't get up it.
Yeah.
But with some effort, the bull probably could have got a, you know, ascended.
It'd be like a Colt 45 commercial. or like the Kool-Aid. Oh, yeah. Right. Just break it in. That would have been crazy. Well, there's a lot of crazy traditions out there. And when it comes to either whether it's road trips or transformative travel or getting out, we're going to talk about a couple of those things. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we are going to talk. What is it? Washington Island. We're going to talk Door County
and Mexico City.
Talk a little Mexico City. So quick break. We'll come back. We'll send it to news live here at 720 WGN. WGN. It is Dane here with you until 5 a.m. Tom Hush is in the booth, and Dave Hammond, you know him as the dining and drinking editor for New City,
hey.
Contributor to a bunch of different publications, including our very own Chicago Tribune. And excited to hear, I know a little bit later we're going to talk hurling, Irish hurling, which was described as, what is it, the combination of ballet?
Soccer, ballet, and murder.
Yeah. And coming from Sturdy and, I guess, in competitive stock is Tom's grandmother played the lady version, the ladylike version of the soccer ballet and murder.
Yeah, camogie.
Camogie.
I'm guessing the same rules apply, right? It's the same sort of game, just with women rather than men.
Well, and I firmly believe that when it comes to the sports of the British Isles, mainly soccer, hurling, lady rugby, not super big, but I'm trying to think.
Gaelic football.
The women are much tougher than the men. It's terrifying now, to watch them play.
By tougher, you mean more?
They're meaner,
aggressive.
Yeah, they're meaner. Yeah, they're crazed. They're getting out a lot of frustration dealing with some of the things that they have to deal with on a daily basis. So I used to be a soccer referee. I did it for probably about 10 years. And I was terrified of refereeing women's matches because they were absolutely brutal. It was hair pulling, it was punching, it was kicking, it was horrible. Amazing players, but they would just get down and dirty, and you would have to literally pull them off of each other.
I will never play women's hurling.
Wow. No. Get your popcorn ready. All right. Well, as people get out there and see the sights and maybe attend some odd sporting matches that that are violent and also entertaining, right? People get in their car, do the road trip thing, and Door County is one of those places that is famous all over. A great place to get away, see some nature, get up into Wisconsin. Beautiful on the scenery side, right? There's some really cool food situations up there. You got the cherries, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, we're going, my wife and I are going next week. We'll be up there for 4 days. And I got to say, Door County is not one of those places I frequently go to because, I mean, we're kind of, we like going to the restaurants, eating street food, going to museums. And they got restaurants up there, but, I mean, zero street food and zero museums. You got to kind of chill and relax and enjoy the natural beauty, which I'm totally ready to do. And some of the local food includes cherries.
I'm sorry.
What's that?
I'm just thinking, you know, you can't live by cherries alone, although cherries are great. I do know. Here's the thing. Cherries are one of the things I don't always have. You know, it's not the kind of thing you always have, maybe like apples or oranges in the refrigerator. And these are things that are just around. Cherries are one of the things that you don't always have. But I am, every time I do have them, I'm reminded like, wow, these are awesome.
And Wisconsin is one of the chief cherry producers in the country. And 95% of those delicious Wisconsin cherries come from Door County. I think because it's kind of northerly and you need like a cooler climate for berries, just like Washington State also produces a lot of berries, blackberries, blueberries, that sort of thing. Door County also has, of course, the legendary fish boil, which is really kind of fun. I went to one of those some years ago, and it's... I mean, they have this big metal pot over a fire.
One big metal pot in the middle of the town?
No. Like, for individual restaurants, gotcha, we'll have, like, the fish boil. All the townspeople gather around.
We're talking about communal.
They bring their fish they caught that day, and they throw it at... No, right. It's at the restaurant.
And where do the bulls fit in with the umbrellas and the spankings?
Oh, I'm sure you can find spankings anywhere, Neil. Mr. Neil. So, yeah, fish boil. They call it a fish boil because, of course, they're boiling the fish, and it's done when it boils over. It's like a boil over. That is the water that's boiling in the pot bubbles over the top, puts out the fire, presumably, and then the fish is ready to eat. And it's usually served with, like, corn and potatoes and stuff like that. And it's so, I mean, it's extremely simple. I'm not sure there's any season. They might put a bay leaf or two in the water, but there's very little seasoning. But the quality of the ingredients is so high. And I got to say, whitefish is one of my least favorite fish, but I like it in a fish boil. And yeah, Door County, it's going to be a chill out, 4 days of just kind of chilling out. And I think it takes like 6 hours or so to drive up there, maybe a little more. Yeah. Have you been there?
I have been there. It's been a while. So the things that I remember, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, and if the listeners, 312-981-7200, if wants to add their thoughts on things to do or not to miss.
I'd love to get some recommendations.
In Door County. It's up there, and I know that... What I remember is kind of that whole thing is like you gotta kind of relax and just chill, right? Just relax, and there's not a lot of excitement. It's more of
right.
A kind of get there and kind of take in that small town ambiance, mm-hmm. Little boardwalky kind of areas where you'd go for souvenirs and kind of you can get a spoon with like a, you know, the state on it or like wooden knickknacks and things like that you can get. And then of course there's that trip to Washington Island, right? You get on the
which is
another whole world in itself.
It was pretty cool. Yeah, we were there in the winter and took an icebreaker across.
Wow.
Death's Door, right? I mean, that's why they call it Door County, because Death's Door is like the waterway between Washington Island and the tip of Door County. Huge Icelandic community. Went to a place called Nielsen's Bar, which specializes in serving shots of Angostura bitters. And this started, we talked about Prohibition before with Irish whiskey and how that really whacked whiskey production in Ireland very seriously. In the United States, during Prohibition, you could get a license to sell shots of Angostura bitters as medicinal. So this Nielsen's Bar in Door County was selling and still sells shots of Angostura bitters. If you take a shot, as we did, you get a membership card in the Bitters Club. And this is kind of funny. Right next door to Nielsen's Bar, this bar that serves Angostura bitters, there's a motel. And the motel is called the bitter end. The way to end your evening after a night of shooting shots of Angostura bitters is you make your way to the Bitter End Motel. And
I mean, it's a great place to get up there. One of the things that that had come through is there's, and it's up in that general area. I don't know if it's specifically Door County, but Al Johnson's is the restaurant. Mm-hmm. It's a restaurant where the roof is grass and there's goats
on the roof.
And
right.
It's a Swedish, right? And you can have Swedish meatballs. And that's definitely some place to check out on the food side.
Yeah, that's like the famous restaurant. That's the restaurant everybody is attracted to going to. It's a classic.
Have you been there?
I have been there. Yeah, we had Swedish pancakes and roast goat, I think. No kidding. We did have roast goat.
the goat is the talent. Right. They got to be taken care of.
Don't eat the talent. Rule number one.
And so we've got 312-981-7200. If you've got a Door County
would love to get a rec.
Story or someplace that you want to share. I know that I think Tom is talking with someone right now. So before we get to the break, that's one of the things. But I always thought, too, is it's one thing to think of the, you know, whether it's the fish boil. But one thing I do and I've always appreciated about Wisconsin, it's really a Wisconsin phenomenon. And I don't know why, because you'd think it would be popular here as well as kind of it's like the fish fry. Like every town in Wisconsin has their own kind of fish fry, whether it's at like the local community center or the American Legion or wherever they would have it, you know.
And sometimes super local fish, too, like bluegills. I'm not sure you can get those anywhere but Wisconsin. They probably are spawned elsewhere, but yeah, that's like a Wisconsin, almost a unique Wisconsin fish.
312-981-7200. We do have Larry. Larry, you've got a Door County story. Welcome to WGN.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, about 20 years ago, I was dating this girl, and we were up there just, you know, hitting different restaurants or whatever, but we went to one of the bays, I forget what bay it was, and we rented a little boat, had like a 10 horse or 20 horse engine on it, real small. Well, the guy told us he was so worried about us going, he's warning us not to go out into the lake, you know, stay in there because he was worried about the prop hitting the rocks, you know, stay away from the shore. Well, she wanted to go out to the lake a little bit more. And long story short, we went out about maybe a block or two, and we ran into 8-foot waves. It's throwing her from the front of the boat to the back where I'm trying to get this thing back. It took us about an hour to get back to the back to the bay so I could get that, you know, stay inside there where the water was, you know, more calm. But when you're talking about death's door, you got that right. But yeah, it was fun, but I mean, it scared the Jesus out of me.
There probably were, I mean, I think they call it death's door because there are so many wrecks and the water is so unpredictable up there.
It was the bay was like glass. And I swear, we got no more than a block outside of that bay, and it was like whitecaps, 8-foot waves.
Jeez.
Well, that's a little
unpredictable.
A cautionary tale. Did you have to sign like a waiver form or something? And did you have...
Waiver,
did you
have, we get it.
not even joking. Did you have life preservers on? Because that sounds actually kind of scary.
Yeah, well, we had life jackets, but we didn't bother to put them on because we were on the bay. But I was so worried about wrecking the guy's prop because of the rocks. As soon as we got outside of the bay, the rocks were, you know, so big that it kept trying to throw us right back into the shore up against these rocks. And I just kept fighting this boat, you know, I didn't want to hurt the guy, you know, wreck the guy's prop on the boat because I'd have to pay for it. But, yeah, it was something. But then we did take the boat to Washington Island. And it was all right, but it's pretty expensive.
Did you go? You didn't by any chance go to Nielsen's Bar, did you?
I could have. We went to a couple of the fish boils, and that's mostly what we did, you know, because she's like into the wine and that. Well, she was, but I'm sure we did probably go to one, you know, that bar or the restaurant or whatever.
Well, thanks, sir. I appreciate it. It's good to have people hear things and maybe get a little insight into maybe some safety first on the boating side. Appreciate you checking in.
And a few less beers.
That's right. Safety first. All right. Thanks, Larry. Talk to you soon. All right, so we are going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to go from probably a world away, right? Mexico City is totally different than Door County.
Although also incredibly close to Chicago. It's like a 3.5-hour flight.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I'm thinking, well, not road trip-wise, right?
But you don't want to drive through northern Mexico.
I mean, safety first, whether it's the boats and the rocks or whether it's maybe the drug cartels, right?
Yeah,
there's always something
to
watch out for.
Which we'll also talk about in reference to Santa Muerte.
Yeah, definitely. So keep it here. We're going to take a break. Wow, all right. Thanks, Tom. 720 WGN high atop Chicago Allstate Skyline Studio in until 5 a.m. It is Dane here with you in for Nick DiGilio, 312-981-7200. You can add your thoughts on road trip destinations. We had a lot of great people kind of kicking in with their suggestions on some crazy foods that they've either had, tried, things that they've would want to suggest. And, of course, we're talking about some of the different travel destinations, some that you can get in the car and head to with your family, and you can suggest those as well, 312-981-7200. And then your thoughts on Mexico. Now, Mexico has been one of those places that has always been a place to go, but there's always been kind of with some places that people say, oh, but you don't want to go here, or here's a safe place and here isn't a safe place. A lot of I think challenges and upheaval and, you know, governmental, whether it's crime or corruption or whatever kind of things are just there. Some beautiful places in Mexico, and it's a great place and great people as a whole as well. Great culture, amazing food. And so some of that's just sort of a challenging backdrop, right? And Mexico City is one of those places that is, it's not near the coast, right? It's in the middle.
Right in the middle.
The middle of the country. It is a huge city of upwards of 10, 15 million people.
Oh, yeah. I forget the exact numbers, but it's big.
It's huge. But also, you know, there's been sort of a reputation. I know that you've been there and you're going to share that it can be a dangerous place. You know, it isn't Cancun or something like that. So let's talk a little
I'm working on a story. In fact, I'm just ready to file a story for the Chicago Tribune about the enduring fascination that Mexico seems to have with skeletons since prehistory. I mean, going back to the Aztec time, there's a fascination with skulls and skeletons. Most recently,
we got the Day of the Dead. I mean, it's a huge, the Day of the Dead, huge holiday.
Interestingly enough, they didn't do a Day of the Dead parade through Mexico City until 2017. After the James Bond movie Spectre, it was the if you remember how Spectre begins, James Bond is in Mexico City during Day of the Dead. There's this incredibly cool looking parade. Everyone's dressed up really fancy in skull masks, and that started Mexico City officials thinking, hey, you know, we should really do something like that. People seem to dig it, and now they have a huge parade.
Wow.
It's another example of
the tail kind of wagging the dog there.
Kinda, yeah, yeah. Now, there is, you mentioned places you don't want to go, and there's so many cool places to go in Mexico City that I don't want to dwell on the more forbidding zones. But there,
and is it widely known, or is it something that you can go to and get some information? I mean, are there certain maybe neighborhoods or areas or regions to stay away from, or is it the kind of thing that even if as you're just exploring as a regular traveler that you may end up running into?
I would say in downtown Mexico City, in most places, very safe as I feel in Chicago. I mean, there's some neighborhoods that are, I mean, I went there recently with my friend Mike Gebert, who writes Food Editor in Chicago, and we were walking around at night in like Roma, which is the namesake of that movie that won an Academy Award last year. Walking around like at 11:30 at night, it was like being on the north side of Chicago. It was perfectly, perfectly comfortable, safe, clean. Now, let's talk about the dangerous place. The National Sanctuary of the Angel of Santa Muerte, also translated as Saint Death or Holy Death. You might have seen this if you watched Breaking Bad. Santa Muerte shows up. She's frequently pictured as a skeleton wearing kind of a bridal veil and a blue dress, kind of a cross between a bride and the Virgin Mary. But she's a skeleton, has a skull's head. And this sanctuary in Mexico City, in a very bad neighborhood, again, I'm not suggesting anyone go there, there's a sanctuary created to her. So I was in Mexico City, and I had a driver. I was traveling solo on this trip, and I asked the driver if we could go to X address, and I showed him the address, and he looked at it. He was like, I think I can take you there. I think so. We drive there. We find it. I'm really glad this guy was with me because he seemed to know his way around. We go into the sanctuary of Santa Muerte.
So you got there, and you actually, now did he stay, or is it like an Uber driver?
He went in with, going? Oh, no, okay. No. He was like a guy I hired for the day. So he went with me. which I was really glad he did, because it was very forbidding inside. I mean, it wasn't really dark or scary, but it had, like, all these, you know, the Santa Muerte represented once or twice, death with, you know, the scythe and the, you know, shawl. There was art.
So the traditional kind of Grim Reaper look?
Yes, right. And they had art all along the wall of Santa Muerte, but it looked a lot like cover art for a Megadeth album. Stuff like, I mean, it was that kind of almost cartoonish kind of scary stuff. There was a family tending the gift shop in there that made zero contact, eye contact with us, and looked really kind of stern and unhappy. Behind the gift shop was like a grate with a dog snarling. Like, I got a video of this. It's really like a dog going, rah, rah, rah. So you're walking through the sanctuary. There's a snarling dog behind a gate. And this is a place that's kind of dedicated to death. There's, in fact, a book out by a University of Virginia professor called Dedicated to Death. It's about the cult of Santa Muerte. And he has some... Yeah.
No, but this isn't, and for the listeners, too, this isn't a cult. This is all, this is sort of a recognized kind of sect within the Catholic faith?
No. It was started by a Roman Catholic priest. The Catholic Church quickly disassociated itself from the sect. I mean, because it's Santa Muerte, the skeleton holy figure, is known for getting things done. She will protect you from your enemies. She will take care of your enemies for you. But she also takes care of love. There's this prayer in the book, Devoted to Death. It goes something like this. Oh, Santa Muerte, send my loved one back to me. And if he will not come, kill him. I mean, it's like whoa, a real mix of, like, I'll help you find love or I'll kill your enemies for you. What do you want?
And I know that it's been in through the conversations that associated with some of the, whether it's the organized crime figures or the members of the drug cartels. Now, is it the kind of thing as a family often has, you know, whatever their religious affiliations, whatever they may be, usually it's an entire family that does it. Is it just the people that are actively associated with the cartel, or is it the whole family? Does everybody go and kind of worship together, or is it just those individuals that maybe need someone killed?
That may happen. However, after we left, the sanctuary, I was with my driver. His name was Armando. And so we're driving back. He's dragging me back to my hotel. And I said, so that was pretty wild, huh? Have you ever been there? And he showed me the fob on his car keys was an image of Santa Muerte. And I said, are you a devotee? And he said, yes. And he said his entire, and we're talking Spanish, so I didn't get everything, but he said his entire Spanish.
So he's like he was a drug lord who's like moonlighting as a driver?
No, it's not just for drug lords. It's for people who want success in business, want success in love. They need something, and they appeal to Santa Muerte and promise something in return. And
your immortal soul?
No, I don't think it's ever like that. It's like, I will, you know, make such and such a offering to the sanctuary of Santa Muerte. I'll do something to pay you back for doing this for me. And the legend goes, you better pay back, or Santa Muerte will come after you big time. So I think it's a good idea to pay back. So this driver, Armando, is telling me about this. You know, his family abandoned him. He used to be a member of the Catholic Church. They're still members of the Catholic Church. He said, would you like to listen to some Santa Muerte music? And I was like, sure.
Is it Megadeth?
No, it wasn't. No, it was some of it was kind of delicate folk songy stuff, but other stuff was, yeah, more metal type stuff. I mean, Santa Muerte is really a blend of, like, someone will help you get love. Someone who will help you whack your enemies. She gets stuff done.
But kind of coded in the trappings of, like, a traditional kind of a Catholic situation, right? Where there's a church, there's an altar.
And I have not been to one of the services, but I'm assuming they do have some. They definitely have, like, get-togethers. In fact, on YouTube, you can find some of these. I guess you'd call it worship services, but it was eerie as hell.
Okay, so there's that part of it for those people who want to experience a little bit of that.
I wouldn't recommend that for the
people who typically want to experience, like, you know, Mexico City, maybe the food, maybe the accommodations, the people. We're going to talk about that when we come back from the. I'm guessing you experienced some of that as well.
Yeah,
it wasn't all the dark side of Mexico City. We saw that. So we're going to take a break. We'll come back. We're going to send it to news. It's staying here on 720 WGN.
Love is a burning
thing. I guess if Johnny Cash did a 23andMe, he would find out that he's 100% Mexican of Mexican descent. 720 WGN here, Allstate Skyline Studio. It is Dane here with you until 5 a.m. Dave Hammond is riding shotgun with us as he's kind of sharing some of his adventures with us as we share them with you. 312-981-7200. Any questions on Mexico or maybe some advice, places to go, places to stay away from? We're getting a little bit of that. But now in this segment, we're going to talk about some of the great reasons that people would want to go there as opposed to just exploring some of the interesting but darker sides of it. Is people go to Mexico because, and during the break, we were talking a little bit about Rick Bayless. I've been interviewing Rick Bayless probably 15 years, and I agree with you. He has been one of their greatest ambassadors, I would think. And he was awarded the Order of the Eagle by the president, because not only has he raised awareness for the culture and the people and certainly the foods, but also, too, especially here as one of kind of our indigenous restaurant stars, although he's, you know, globally known and appreciated, is the kind of the finer dining side of the Mexican cuisine. He's doing some of that, but also all those great street foods, and I'm sure you experienced those in Mexico City too.
Yeah, that is actually my favorite. When we were visiting, my friend and Mike and I were visiting Mexico in May, I think it was, Mexico City. We made reservations at this place, Quintanil, which was going to be our one big expensive meal, and it wasn't terribly expensive. I mean, I think we both ate for like $130 or something like that. And Quintanil placed on the Pellegrino best restaurant list. You know, it's recognized as a great restaurant, and the meal was really good. But when we both reflected on the meal we liked the most in Mexico City, it was this street food gordita we bought. We were just walking along the street one day, and Gebert said, why don't we get one of these? So we just bought one from this mother-daughter team. They were making gorditas, which is basically just like a kind of like a pita made out of cornmeal that's split open, and there's cheese in there and other, I don't think there's any meat, a cheese, onions, hot sauce. Extraordinarily simple. But watching this young woman make this gordita, it took her like 5 minutes to make something that simple, because she was like getting the cheese just right and griddling it just right. And she had this big smile on her face the whole time, and actually took like a stealth photo of her. I just kind of held the camera by my head so she didn't know I was shooting her. And
you don't want any self-conscious gordita making happening.
Well, she was smiling the whole time, and it wasn't because she knew I was taking her picture. She was just loving what she was doing. And afterwards, I mean, Gebert and I were talking. It's like, what was your best meal? Was it the $130 one at Quintanil, or was it like the $1.50 gordita we bought? And we both like that gordita much more. And my feeling with street food is, you know, a lot of times the best stuff, certainly the highest value, is going to be stuff you get on the street. That's the clearest reflection of a local culture. It's what the local people are eating. A lot of times they're not doing anything fancy. They're not aspiring to fine dining. They're just making the food that the people around there like to eat. Here's a weird example of a street food we got. Dory Locos. This is from a trip my wife and I took last year. We're walking through Chapultepec Park. It's the big park in Mexico City. We see all these signs for Dory Locos Preparados, prepared Dory Locos. So we see it. Finally, like I say, I got to get these Dory Locos, see what they are. So my wife speaks fluent Spanish, so she was talking to the nice lady. We said we'd like an order of Dory Locos. So first the lady said, well, you select your Doritos. So I went with
You went with the Cool Ranch. Those are my favorite.
I went with the original. I figured, you know, I'll just go straight with this one.
Really? It's really Doritos?
It's a bag of Doritos. She opens the bag of Doritos. Oh, wow. She puts in some diced carrots, some diced celery, some onions, some pickled pig skin, some hot sauce, and gummies.
What?
I'm not kidding. Gummies. And I tell you, my wife looked at it and said, oh, that looks like a stomach ache. She had like a little piece and like turned up her nose at it, and I ate the whole thing, and then she's the one who got sick.
Oh my god!
But I really liked it. I tried to make them at home. I mean, I got the Doritos. I got the you need chamoy in there too, which is like a Mexican ketchup. Sprinkle that in there. Hot sauce, the diced celery and carrots,
some gummies.
The gummies. I didn't have the pickled pig skin either, and it wasn't anywhere near as good as what I had in Mexico City. And I think because a woman who's made these like 10,000 times knows the right proportions to put into it. And it was, I really liked it. Now, I understand, and I haven't actually gone in search of this, but like the Neverias, the Mexican ice cream places that we talked about earlier on the show, some of those sell Dory Locos. So if you want to try it...
And they do it right in the bag, so it's kind of like a walking taco, yeah,
like,
except...
Exactly.
But like, with like a novelty side. You know, was it the kind of thing that was there for... like on the tourism side, hey, you're going to trust, or did you see like just like regular
people?
It was
local. Chapultepec Park, it's like a big, it's this huge park where a lot of Mexicans go, like on holidays, on weekends, kind of like Central Park in New York, and probably about as big. People just lounging around, and they're walking around, they're visiting, there's a castle up there where Maximilian and his wife lived before they were overthrown by the Mexicans. And people are buying snacks, you know, like they do along the lakefront. And Dory Locos, and they also have...
So it's like the Garrett's popcorn of of Mexico City?
It is. It's a street food that I'm sure was developed in Mexico with the ingredients they had at hand. It sounds weird, but I'll tell you, we talked about some of the weird Chicago foods, like sure. The peppermint stick and the pickle and so on. I'm sure people in Mexico City would think that was at least as weird as Dory Locos.
On the accommodation side, and that's one of the things about Mexico and traveling there, whether it's on the resort side and some of the more kind of maybe familiar or touristy locations, or whether it's a place like Mexico City, is it... And you mentioned that as long as you stay to certain areas and basically the middle of the town, you feel pretty safe. Are there deals? Are there things that you'd recommend? Is it you stay with a hotel chain, or are there some cool kind of more authentic places you can stay that would be great too?
We have always stayed in Airbnbs. Usually, we pick the neighborhood. You know, a neighborhood like Roma, because I think you get a better flavor for the city when you stay in a neighborhood outside the center of the city, which would tend to attract more tourists. Nothing against tourists. I'm one myself. But I think you get a better feel for the town by going into the neighborhoods. And also, an Airbnb, you're staying with a Mexican guy, a Mexican woman, a Mexican family or whatever, in either a room in their house or an apartment in their building, which is the way we stayed the last time we were there. And also, you get a kitchen, you frequently get a kitchen, which is nice. That means you can buy raw ingredients like cheeses and tortillas and so on, and maybe eat something, you know, make something in your room.
Is there like typical grocery stores that you can do, or is it a lot of the kind of open markets where you would get stuff?
Yes.
I think having the family there too, it's almost, you know, if they're, I think, savvy enough or open to, you know, kind of putting it out there on the Airbnb side and usually having tourists, you know, it's almost like having your own concierge, right?
And suggesting things. It is. And it's, in the sense that if you have questions like if you want to take public transit, you can talk to these people how do I get here to there, where can I, you know, I'm really in the mood for some type of a mole, where shall I go? They'll know that because they live there. And also, it's kind of cool to be able to connect with a local that way.
I mean, you're
living in their building, maybe even, you know, if you have a room, you're actually living in their apartment. They'll be able to offer insights that only a very qualified concierge would be able to give you.
It's exciting stuff. We'll have links up at WGNradio.com as well. And I know, David, so when is the article coming out in the Tribune about the...
It should be right before Day of the Dead, because I'm going to be exploring the origins of the Day of the Dead. And also this fascination that Mexican people, since before Cortez, seem to have had in skulls and skeletons. I mean, even if you walk around any time of year in Mexico City, you'll see tables set out with little clay skulls being sold, or sugar skulls. You know, you can actually eat them. They're not that good. They're just like eating a sugar cube or something.
Now it tastes like skull, right?
Tastes like skull.
All right. When we come back, we're going to take a break. And when we come back from the break, we're going to highlight a great event that's coming up this weekend. That is the Mutts on Midway event for Speakeasy Customs. So you're going to stay tuned.
This is Ash with Mutts of Midway, and I'm on the road with Dane at WGN.
Get your motor running.
720 WGN on the road with Dane, live here in the Allstate Skyline Studio, high atop Chicago. And in studio with us, we have one of our favorite people when it comes to cars, cool cars, when it comes to making them and taking them around the world. Speakeasy Customs and Classic does it as well, or better, I would say better, than anyone. And visionary and driving force behind so much of what happens there. Greg Alonso is in studio with us. Greg, welcome to WGN.
Thanks for having me again, Dane.
Well, you know, you're here because you're always doing stuff. You never stop, whether it's creating cars that are taken around the world to the Geneva Car Show, George Bear stuff, whether it's making amazing trophies, right, for the
BBQ
Smoke down at Chicagoland Speedway, or winning World of Wheels or all that stuff, or kind of the softer side of Speakeasy, right? Helping out some of our neediest friends, and some of them have four legs, with Mutts of the Midway. And excited also to have online with us, we've got Ash Archer. She is with Mutts of the Midway. Ash, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Dane.
Okay, so Greg, I know that you have talked about this, and we've promoted, and you've had other events that are related to the shop as well. So this is not something that comes out of left field for you. Your support of whether it's animal adoption or whether it's dog rescue or whether it's just dogs in general is something that you, the shop, your family have been a part of for a long time.
Yeah, my wife, Carolyn, actually runs a pet care service, Fetch Pet Care, here in the city. And so she's been doing that for 12 years. So we've always been involved with animal rescue for about, you know, as long as I can remember. We've got four dogs that are all four rescues, and hopefully maybe another one in the works.
Wow.
But we'll see.
You never know. You get caught up in the moment in one of these events, right?
Exactly. You know, and so we've always been very passionate about trying to give back to the community and help out as much as we can with the rescues that are here in the city.
Well, you're one of those guys that's always putting his money where his motors are, right? And
yes.
And so this is, and where the Mutts are too. So let's talk a little bit about this specific event. It's coming up on August 3rd, so you got a little time to plan, and people, you get an opportunity to get down there, see the shop, see some great cars, see some great dogs, and you guys have built a lot of fun into it as well.
Oh yeah, for sure. So besides, obviously all the proceeds will be benefiting Mutts of the Midway this time, but we got a lot of fun stuff going on. For example, Jose Santiago Jr., he's an actor, local actor here. He's been on Chicago PD and also the Chirac series. He's going to be joining us at
local,
the show.
So local but nationally known.
Yes, local but nationally known. He will be at the show, shaking hands, meeting people. We're going to be doing a pinup girl contest, which we just did a photo shoot last weekend. So we're going to start pushing pictures. You guys will be able to see all those pictures online. And we're also going to have homemade trophies again by us at Speakeasy.
I think that sells a little short, like custom trophies. Not homemade, sounds like I made it with some popsicle sticks and Elmer's.
it's a macaroni noodles, right? No. These are going to be a little fancier than that. But we're going to have trophies, and there will be $20 entries for cars. All the money will go to the rescue. And Five River Brewery will also be donating beer that will be selling for donations as well. So all the money goes to the rescue.
A great cause and a festive environment there with the Five Rabbits as well. So let's talk a little bit about Mutts of the Midway. On the line with us, we mentioned we've got Ash Archer, one of the founding members. So there are a lot of great causes out there, and some of the best ones have to do with dogs. We love them as a family as well, but you guys have kind of a special place in the area as one of the very few doing this great work in that part of Chicagoland.
Yeah, definitely. When we got together just over a year ago with some of our initial meetings with our other board members, you know, we all kind of felt like there was a presence missing on the south side, especially we're foster based, we're volunteer run. We wanted to bring rescue to the Midway area, to the community, and we're only 10 months old, but within those 10 months, we've had 51 dogs rescued and 40 adoptions. So we're very proud of those numbers, and we have had a lot of local response. Again, Greg, thank you so much for the work that you've put into this event. We're very excited for it, and you know, we definitely couldn't have done this without you, and we're excited to have a partnership in the neighborhood as well.
Yeah, you're welcome. Like she said, a lot of the members and board members all live within just a couple miles of the shop, so it's kind of a no-brainer for us to work with them, and we're super excited too.
I mean, it's a great fit, right, to have Speakeasy be able to do what it is that they do at the highest level, showcase some of those cars, and then bring in, you know, as a conversation starter, some of the dogs. And what's cool about it, let's talk, Ash, about, you know, the whole, you've got sort of the mindset in an all-inclusive way. There are some rescues out there that are specific to one kind of breed or not. Nothing against that. I think everybody helping is great. But I saw some of the pictures, and we'll have them up at WGNradio.com. You kind of include all dogs.
Yeah, definitely within the name Mutts. You know, we large dogs, small dogs, old dogs, young dogs. You know, we want to help any dog that we can. And a lot of it, too, is being foster-based. You know, we look at the availability of our foster home, and as soon as a foster home opens up, we're getting to the shelters and we're evaluating dogs. You know, if the foster's ready for another dog, we love to occupy that home with a dog just to open up a kennel at the shelter.
Now, the mutts, the word mutts, you know, are you doing, you going the extra mile, doing like a 23andMe just to make sure that they are like verified mutts? You know, there's no purebreds allowed, or is it just everybody, right?
It's just everybody. You know, we definitely won't hold pure breed against any dog either, though. So any dog is welcome into the rescue.
And I would imagine, Ash, finding the fosters are probably some of the hardest parts of this right now, right?
Yeah, we had a lot of fosters step up in the beginning, and a lot of fosters that have stuck with us from the very beginning, and we really appreciate that. And some new along the way, and then some that need a break. So foster recruitment is definitely something that we have to keep up on, so again, we can continue rescuing dogs. You know, we set a pretty hefty goal of for the 2019 year to rescue 60 dogs, and we're kind of right on pace, and you know, we're excited to reach that goal and to help at least 60 dogs this year.
Let the listeners know we're talking with Ash Archer. She is one of the founding members of Mutts of the Midway, and you bring that up, you know, and we'll have links up at WGNradio.com for it as well. Explain to the listeners what they may not know if they go to, let's say, a shelter where you have sort of a kennel situation for people to look at. Explain the difference between that and then having it kind of a foster-based system where I guess the dogs are really kind of staying with people until they're adopted.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, a little bit different than going to the shelter. There's definitely, you know, volunteers that are taking the dogs out at the shelters and really trying to get to know the dogs. So then the dogs that are getting adopted out there definitely have some feedback to those adopters on their personalities. But, you know, you really get in a foster home, you get to learn kind of all the quirks of dogs, and you know, we get to do some kind of in-home training with the fosters. You know, they're working on crate training, house training, and again, we do meet and greets in our process because we want to make sure that the dogs really fit within the family. Any dogs that the adoptive family might already have, we do a meet and greet with the dogs too to make sure it's the right fit all around. We want to make sure that we're setting up any dog for success, and the fosters really, you know, they help us out. They're the ones, they know the dogs that have been in their home, and they can relay all of that information to the potential adopters to, again, set the dog and the family up for success in the end.
You know, another thing I noticed, Ash, is that you guys also help rescue a lot of older and senior dogs, many of which are in their last, you know, couple years, even months. I believe you call it hospice for a foster. So I just wanted to maybe have you say something about that, too, since I know that's probably one of the more difficult, on top of even fostering in general, that's probably one of the more difficult ones to fill. So, you know, just wanted to let you talk a little bit about that and why there's a need for that.
Yeah, there's definitely always a need, you know, those dogs getting surrendered, or whether it's a stray ending up at the shelter, they're very disoriented, and it's the last place that they want to be, and it's the last place that, you know, any rescue wants them to be. And fostering is definitely hard. You know, you never know how much time that as a foster you will have with that dog. But, you know, for them to be in a safe place to live out the rest of their life in a comfortable home, definitely it takes a special foster to do that. And, you know, we have a couple of those that have stepped up for some older dogs as we figure out kind of some of their medical situations and, you know, any additional medical that those dogs might need, and those fosters are very patient. And again, you know, it's a hard decision to have to make, but you're looking out for the dog, and you want to do what's best for the dog, and keeping them healthy and happy and in a comfortable home.
Well, you know what, it's kind of one of the probably most rewarding things that you can do, because you're doing it kind of for the dog, for the family too, if everybody gets that. And another guest on today's show is our buddy Joe Gatto from Impractical Jokers, and he's big in the dog adoption and all that, and their family always takes an older dog, and the thought process is to give them, you know, some great times on the way out, right, when they maybe have had some tough and challenging times. So I think that's a really rewarding thing, and it's going to be great coming up on August 3rd at Speakeasy. So So Greg, the address for people to show up, obviously, to be there, to be a part of it, to compete, right? The car show, there's going to be awards and prizes?
Oh, yeah. There's going to be at least the first, second, and third. Like I said, we're also going to have a special award for Best Impala. And the address is 5235 West 65th Street in Bedford Park. You can also find out a lot more information if you go to our Facebook page. Look for the event page for the benefit for Mutts of the Midway. And you can see there's a lot of other information. We're going to have a huge raffle. You can find out more about those prizes on the website. We're posting pretty much a couple times a day at this point as far as what's going to be available in the raffle. So please come out, give us some support, listen to some music, have some food, see some cars, and just have a good time.
It's going to be great. And then, Ash, too, for those people that are hearing about this right now, want to get involved on the Foster side or maybe come out and see you at the event, or maybe when the smoke clears from this one, wants to get more involved and participate long term, where's a place where they can get more information on Mutts of the Midway?
They can definitely send us an email at muttsofthemidway@gmail.com. We do have a Facebook page up and running, and they can always reach out via message, any of our posts. We'll give them the links to either apply to foster, adopt. You know, we're always looking for volunteers for any of our events that we have. And again, any of our fosters, adopters, donors, or supporters, we really appreciate along the way.
It's going to be a great event when you can combine the amazing cars from Speakeasy Customs with a great cause. I think you've got a recipe for something really special. So excited about it. Well, like I said, we'll have links up at WGNRadio.com. And Ash, thanks so much for what you're doing. Appreciate it in every way, as I know all of those dogs and all of your fellow supporters do. And Greg, thanks again for everything that you're doing, not only on the car side, but also on the cause side.
You're very welcome. And thanks again for having me, Dane.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Dane.
WGN high atop Chicago in the Allstate Skyline studio. It is Dane here with you until 5 a.m. Dave Hammond, you know him as the dining and drinking editor for New City, contributed to so many of our great publications, including our own Chicago Tribune. Tom Hush is in the booth as well and on the line with us, excited to have, calling all the way from Ireland. He is the head distiller at the Waterford Distillery, the one and only Ned Gahan. Ned, welcome to WGN.
Hi, Ned.
Hi, Dave. Hi, Dane. Delighted to be with you all the way from Waterford, Ireland here.
How did your dentist appointment go?
Oh, jeez.
It went well, yeah. It was booked in for this morning, so I told her I was going to be on the radio in Chicago, so she may be tuned in. I think the guys in work here are tuned in, so you have a good few listeners here from Waterford. So I think she may have altered the work a little bit, just so the whole mouth is not numb.
Hold the Novocaine, right, good. So we talked a little earlier about the approach you're taking at the Waterford Distillery. Waterford,
yes, yeah,
on the east side of Ireland, former Viking settlement. Great history. Please go ahead, Ned.
So Waterford's southeast of Ireland. It's called the sunny southeast, and old. It's the oldest city in Ireland. Founded by the Vikings and that, and we have a rich tradition of tourism and industry. Crystal, obviously, being one of the better known industries. So brewing and distilling, the distillery here was originally built in 1792, so it's here for a good few years, and we hope to keep that tradition going for a long time.
And what makes the approach at Waterford Distillery different than the approach of other Irish distilleries? We talked a little about Mark Renier's very precise analyses of different barley fields, for instance. Could you talk a little to that?
Yeah, so I suppose what we are doing is we are looking at individual farms. So normally what would happen is barley is malted, so it's malted barley, and it goes just into a generic pile of thousands of tons, and it goes into the different places then, so for brewing and for distilling. But what Mark has done is he has set it up so that we have individual batches from individual farms. So we would look at getting roughly about 110 tons of barley from a farm, and using that throughout the whole process and keeping it separately. So what we would have done at the start is worked in partnership with Minch Malt, who are our maltsters, and they worked with the farmers then. So normally what would happen is the grain is brought into the merchant. But I suppose terroir is what we're kind of being known for, but it's also, we look at it as the Holy Trinity, or the three T's. So terroir, traceability, and transparency. So to ensure that, we actually, when I say we now, it's actually Minch Maud in conjunction with Dalton's, who store the grain for us in Kilkenny, will go out and they will collect the grain and they will bring it in into Dalton's and it's dried. So what we have there then is what we call the cathedral. So that's a purpose-built warehouse where we can store individual farms. So that grain is dried, so get roughly 110 tons of barley in, and it's dried to maybe just a little under 100 tons. And that's stored in individual bays then until we require it. So I suppose that's, you know, the starting point. So we keep each farm separate, so it's a component or an ingredient when we go to put our whiskies together.
Now, I wanted to ask you, this is like the reason behind it. Now, and people love to get, it's one of the great things that we have now, whether it's food or spirits, is to be able to get kind of that lineage, the backstory of it, and kind of learn where everything is coming from. Are you guys doing it to kind of tie into that sort of situation, or just because the technology is available, or are you looking for specific flavor profiles with the expressions?
So I suppose we're doing it because it's, we believe that, whiskey comes from barley, the flavour comes from barley. So to do that, we need to be able to keep the farm separate so we can use it as a component or an ingredient. So terroir then is the influence of the climate, man, and conditions on the field. So barley is a crop. So in Ireland, we don't have a lot of level fields. We may have fields that are undulating. So if you can imagine a field that has a dip in it, that field may get more rain lodging there, staying there. So you have a wet soil. And at the top of the field, it may be a bit more drier. So the local influences there, you may have trees that are blocking frost or sun. So that will influence the flavours of the barley. So it's to be able to create, and this is Mark's words as well, the most profound whiskey in the world. So it's to make a complex whiskey. It's to give us ourselves the opportunities to be able to say we will put some of David Welch Chemist's farm with Ed Harper's farm, with Robert Millen's farm, with Billy O'Brien's farm, and see what flavours we get. So it's working with nature to see what would it would provide. So I suppose when you look at our whiskey, it's completely natural. So we don't use any additives throughout any of the process. So when you look at it, it'll be barley, yeast, water, and the casks, and that's it.
And the barrel is the casks. The barrel is very important to the final product, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So I suppose there is a bit of a debate out there at the moment about how much flavor comes from the cask. And sometimes you'll hear 60 or 70 or 80% of a cask's of a whiskey's flavor comes from a cask. And we probably have a different view on it. And what we would say is that 100% of the spirit is influenced by 100% of the cask. So what the cask that we buy is the normal cask bought in distilleries the world over is the ex-bourbon cask. So, you know, your casks from Heaven Hill or any of those, Jack Daniels, those are the casks that are used primarily in all distilleries. But what we do is we break down each farm into four different cask types. So when we produce spirit from, we'll say, Ed Harper's farm, 50% of that farm goes into American Forestville. 20% will go into American Virgin cask, so American oak never used. 15% goes into French premium casks. The kind of casks we buy are Mouton Rothschild, Chateau Lafite, casks of that caliber. And the other 15% goes into what we call Vin du Naturel, VDN. So those are sweet, fortified wines, sherry, port, Madeira.
Wow.
Because we're not using Caramel E150, we're dependent on the casks for a colour. So normally the biggest bill in a distillery is your barley. And second bill then is maybe utilities. Your wood bill might be down. And if a distillery has to save money, they will cut the wood and the quality of the wood. Our second biggest bill at the distillery here in Waterford is our wood. 30% of our money each year goes on wood. Now, we can afford to do that. We're in a good position where we have good financial backers, and we can afford to do that. And I think that's something that Mark learned when he was in Brookladdy, that they didn't have money to buy good quality casks. And when it came to time to bottle, the cask had no influence, really. So what we would say is that 100% of our spirit is influenced by 100% of the cask.
If
that makes sense.
Fascinating stuff. You've got all of that tradition. You've got all of that know-how, and then you're building in a little bit, or maybe a lot, right, of the science side into it as well. I want to let the listeners know we're talking with Ned Gahan. He's the head distiller over at Waterford Distillery. And when we come back from this break, we're going to talk a little bit about where you can get it, where you can get more information
and
about
when you can get it. I mean, it's a new distillery.
And when you can get it, so people can be up to speed and ready to get in on that. Plus, I think we're going to talk a little hurling as well before we let Ned go. So stay tuned for that.
I took a stroll on the old long walk of the day. I met a little girl and stopped to talk of a fine soft day.
720. WGN, it is Dane here in the Allstate Skyline studio in until 5 a.m. I've got David Hammond with me as well. And on the line with us, calling all the way from Ireland, is Ned Gahan. He is the head distiller for Waterford Distillery. Ned, welcome back.
Thanks, Dane.
So here's the thing, is that you've described such an intriguing combination, thought process, vision, everything that goes along with what it is that you're doing. And I know people that are fans of the spirit world are excited about this. So let's hear a little bit about how people are going to be able to get at it, when, right, and kind of where this is all going to go from here.
Yeah, so I suppose we're kind of just looking at all that at the moment, Dane. But I suppose what we would be envisaging for next year is having a few small releases. So maybe around May time next year, we will have a dual release, a kind of a contrast release, maybe two single farms. those will probably be available in retail shops. So we're working through that at the moment. We're also looking at doing an online release around the same time. With some talk of having maybe a pété cuvée, so a small mixture of number of farms, and maybe a couple of releases then towards the end of the year. So I think plus that 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 or 7 small releases next year, because obviously we started distilling in February of 2016, so the spirit itself is young, but we won't release anything until we're happy with the quality. So while we're looking at those timelines, it'll have to get the nod that we're happy with quality before we do anything. And in terms of volume, it probably won't be huge volume. There is a bit of a clamber at the moment for people looking for bottles when we're going to release. So we're conscious of that as well, that people are waiting patiently for the water whiskey. But when we release it, it will be something that we're happy to release in terms of quality and that. So that's kind of the working at the moment. But with all these things, it can move slightly. I'd probably get a phone call in a half an hour going, that's all changed.
Well, but it's exciting stuff, and it's cool to have the anticipation there for it. So that's, yeah, I think, to be commended that you've created something that has got people's attention peaked. And I know, like you had said, you want to make sure that it's as great as people know and as you know it can be before you release it to the world. So we're excited for that. We'll have links up at WGNRadio.com. And so I know we had mentioned it, and we definitely want to do it. Our producer, Tom Hush, his grandmother is from, is it County Mayo? Tom?
Yeah, she's from County Mayo.
And she actually participated in hurling, the ladylike version of hurling, which is called, what was it, Tom?
I believe it's Camogie, isn't it?
It's called Camogie.
Camogie, that's right, Tom. Yeah. That's right, Tom. Yeah, yeah.
So Ned, let's talk a little bit about hurling. David tried to explain it. He said it's a combination of was it ballet, soccer, and murder?
Yes. Right?
So talk about hurling.
Well, yes, ballet, that would be an unusual one to put in there. But yeah, I suppose our national games are the GAA, or the Gaelic Athletic Association. So hurling and Gaelic football are the two main ones. And there's also ladies' versions, so Camogie are women's Gaelic football. So, yeah, so when I was talking to Dave and Caroline there when they were over, I showed them a YouTube clip of it. And that weekend they were heading down towards Kinsale in County Cork.
Yeah,
and I'm from Kilkenny, which is just over the border here from Waterford. And that weekend, Kilkenny were playing Cork in an All-Ireland quarter-final. So the match itself, I think, Dave, did you get to see it, was fairly good. Did you enjoy it?
Oh, yeah, it was very exciting. I mean, we were watching it in Cork, yeah. So of course the crowd was cheering every time there was a good move by that team. We talked a little before we got you on about the non-professional nature of... The players, that is, do they not receive any compensation for what they're doing?
So it's an amateur organization. It's run professionally in that the guys at the head of the organization are full time officials, but the participants are don't get paid for it. So we're actually just a couple of weeks away from the All Ireland Hurling Final, which is the centerpiece of the hurling championship. And my beloved Kilkenny have qualified, and they will be playing Tipperary, which are a neighbouring county to Kilkenny, and have had a huge rivalry over the last 19 years, probably. So Kilkenny had been thought to be on a little bit of a decline after winning a number of championships, but surprised probably a lot of people by qualifying for the All-Ireland this year. So Tipperary will be hoping to stop Kilkenny winning another title. But on the day itself, there'll be 82,500 people at the match.
Wow.
cheering on hard, and there's no segregation at the games. Everyone sits together, and you have some good fun, or you'll have a row, or you'll have... But at the end of the game, then it's done. So the players don't get any... they're not paid for it, basically. Everyone would have a full-time job. But they do get expenses for travel and stuff.
Sure.
And over the last couple of years, it's probably improved immensely in that they get all the compensation now in terms of expenses.
And medical.
And,
medical.
And medical and things. Like, yeah, well, I suppose, you know, after seeing the match, Dave, you probably would see there's a few injuries that can occur.
Mm-hmm.
It's only in recent times that they're actually compulsory to wear full-face guard helmets. Prior to probably 8 or 10 years ago, you didn't have to, and you might get a little slap on the head and some blood or clout may have been drawn. But you just wipe it off and get on with it. So, yeah, it's going back hundreds of years, I suppose. The GA was founded around 1884, and it goes back to stories of Cuchulainn hurling, and it was a big wolf, seemingly, that was attacking him, and he hit the ball. It's called a slither, and he hit it into his mouth and stopped the wolf from attacking. So whether it was a wolf found a wolf or not, I might be totally wrong, but that's kind of the background of it. So the 32 counties would play hurling and football at different levels. Actually, Tom's beloved Mayo are always the perennial bridesmaids. So they have a big match now on the weekend where they're playing... who are they playing? They're playing... Mayo are playing... Can't think of who they're playing now. But they need to win that match to stay in the football championship.
Oh.
So, yeah, so that's kind of... it's. So I suppose you would have rivalries. I don't know who would be a rivalry of maybe the Chicago Cubs, someone like the Cardinals.
Yes, yeah.
Would that be a rivalry?
Yeah, for sure.
Would it be a bitter rivalry?
I would say it's as bitter as baseball gets, yeah. So
So you'll have that in the counties. And here in Waterford, I suppose, Waterford in the last few years have had some very, very good teams, never really pushed through to the final stage. So we would say Kilkenny have the most All-Ireland titles. They have 36. We say Waterford would have two. So that's going back to probably 1884 that I think the records probably began.
Wow.
So Kilkenny have been on a roll. Their Cody is a man called Brian Cody, and he's been there 19 years and has taken something like 16 All Ireland or something like that. So he is the GOAT, as you might say in America.
So here's the thing, too, is the tensions are high, the competition is, and they're playing 80,000 people watching, and the biggest thing that they're getting is bragging rights and hopefully a little bit of health insurance, right? So it's exciting stuff,
yeah.
And let the listeners know we're talking with Ned Gay, and he is the hurling authority and also the head distiller at Waterford Distillery. So we'll have links up for all that stuff, and before we let you go, if you've got a website that you want to give out for people to keep up with all the activity and progress, go ahead and give that out, too.
Yeah, so if you just Waterford Distillery, if you look it up, we have all information there, and we will have hopefully updates of when we're going to be releasing and stuff. You'll see articles there that kind of explain our philosophy. We're very much farmer centred as well, so when we talk about barley, you know, we can talk about the farmer and stuff and that. So, like, when eventually the bottle will be released, potentially if it's a single farm release, we can tell you the day that the field was sown and every detail that has happened to the bottle stage. So full traceability, full transparency, and overall, I suppose we are using 100% Irish grain, which some people might be a little bit horrified to hear that not all Irish whiskey uses all Irish grain. So we'll just leave it at that for the time being.
And so, Ned, like, quickly, the website for it before we let you go?
So it's www.waterforddistillery.ie.
WaterfordDistillery.ie. We'll have links up at WGNRadio.com. Can't thank you enough for jumping on.
Thanks a lot, Ned.
On the show today,
great
Ned. Look forward to talking to you soon. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call, Dane and Dave. And say hello to Caroline as well, Dave.
We'll do that.
All right, thanks, man. All right, Ned Gahan. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We're going to send it to news and opening bell. Stay tuned, 720 WGN.